Ladies and gentlemen, it's that time of year for the annual wrap-up, and of course our first section is news, trends, and stories. We have six sections this time. They're all presented on your web presentation, and so I would encourage you to follow along as Dr. Farrell and I chew through the stories. This news, trends, and stories took much longer than it normally does because there is change everywhere. And so we have a great deal to talk about. And as you know, when I'm trying to figure out things and chew through things, it's Dr. Farrell I turn to. So it's always a privilege and a pleasure to have him join me for these conversations. We learn a lot, even though that we've gone through it several times before. So Joseph, thank you so much for joining us for the annual wrap-up news, trends, and stories. This is part one. We're going to talk about economy and financial markets, and then geopolitics and culture. And then next week we'll be talking about science, technology, and then the unanswered questions and inspiration, where we get our inspiration. So much to cover, many interesting things happening. So Joseph, welcome to the Solari Report, and aren't you glad 2016 is over?
Oh, boy, am I. Thanks for having me back. But, boy, you said it all right there. You know, I thought we'd never get through that slog, through that election mess, you know. It just seemed to drag on and on. But thanks for having me back on.
You know, if you look at the statistics, consumer confidence is up a lot. Small business confidence is up. And now there's another indicator that shows, you know, mood, morale is up. And I think they're all just so happy that there's no presidential election this year.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. I really do. You know, it's not so much Trump effect as election's over and we don't have to endure Hillary effect. So I think that's a large part of it.
I just think the whole process. I think people are relieved they don't have to go through the whole process. Well, for many years, since I started doing the annual wrap-up, Joseph, I've said in my scenarios that we put in the get ready section that it's very high probability of slow burning for another year. Mm-hmm. And this is the first year I've ever done an annual wrap-up where I'm going to say there's less than a 50% chance of the slow burn happening. And that's because we are coming into very serious and significant change.
Yes,
and so
I agree.
In economy and financial markets, that's really what I want to focus on because we're coming into a turn and, you know, the reality is no one knows what's going to happen. If you look at the scenarios we did this year, on the horizontal axis, we have whether or not we can turn taxpayer money into a positive return versus a negative return, or, of course, it could go more deeply. So that's the axis, and then the unipolar and the multipolar world is on the vertical axis. And if you look at the four quadrants, the variability of what could happen here is just astonishing.
Yeah.
Whatever
it's all four quadrants are up for grabs.
Right, exactly. So this is a, you know, the good news on this is a time you can make a difference. But I want in the economy and financial market section to go through some of the things that are changing or causing this change. Now, you and I have been talking about it in the quarterly wrap-ups all year, but I think, you know, now that the election is over, there's a lot that's been held back, and now it's going to roll out. So let's start with what I call the Global 2.0, from slow burn to pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. Global 2.0 is my expression. In fact, you helped me invent it when I came and threw myself at your mercy, and I said, I can't figure out what's going on in the economy. You have to help me figure this out. And that's when we came up with this idea of Global 2.0 and Global 3.0, the financial coup moving assets out of Global 2.0 that includes the traditional governments and pulling the assets out but leaving the liabilities behind. And we always knew we'd come into this time when the liabilities would become, you know, current expenses and the assets would be gone. And the question was, what was the end game? So I think the end game is now beginning. And and so the first thing I wanted to talk about was what I call controlled demolitions accelerating. I think we're coming into just a tsunami of different institutions whose liabilities are coming due. The assets are gone. There's short funding. We've kicked the can as far as it can go. And now, now you have to face the liabilities and you don't have the funding to meet them.
Right.
So I don't know if you saw recently, CalPERS, for the first time in their history, just cut pension benefits for the municipal employees of one town in California.
Yep.
And that is an enormous bellwether event.
Oh, yes. I saw that because you had it linked in the materials that you sent me. And I looked at a lot of those articles that you sent. That CalPERS decision was one thing that I looked at. You referenced also the Dallas Police and Firemen Pension Fund is suspending pension withdrawals. The thing that really grabbed my attention here, Catherine, was something that you and I have talked about privately. And that was the story that you linked about Britain, where the pension age may be about to rise again.
Right.
And I began to think about that in terms of your model of controlled demolitions and why they would do that. And there's another story, I think, that may be linked to this controlled demolition model. And we haven't linked it before, but I think it's worth tossing out there for people to be aware of, particularly in terms of possible investment strategies and so on. And that is that we have been seeing for the last year, this began actually about 2 to 3 years ago, but in the last year we've seen a lot of stories kind of accelerating in various articles and journals, scientific journals, popular journals, about medical technology is getting to the point where they are talking very, very seriously now about serious human life extension, longevity, by various means. We're seeing all sorts of genetic technology now. They're 3D printing human organs from tissue that donors donate. They're doing this in the laboratory now, but I suspect that this is going to roll out very soon. And this will mean that you no longer have the transplant part of the medical industry doing quite the business that it has done so far, when you can simply grow, 3D print the organs. So if you look at the necessity of extending the eligibility age for various pensions, particularly government-sponsored pensions in the West, I think that the hidden part of this is longevity. The longevity medical technology, I think, is yet another way that's going to be introduced to extend the demolition, and it's quite literally, to use your analysis, harvest the wealth of people for a much longer period of time. And that will offset some of the bad paper, quite literally, if I can put it bluntly, some of the bad paper on their ledger books, and take some of the squeeze off of these pension funds. So that's something that people need to look at and consider as they're watching these stories of longevity. There's a financial aspect that I think is driving this, and I think that's why these stories are now being circulated so much in the Western media.
Right. Well, technology is a big wild card, because technology has the ability to solve many of the problems
right
before us. The question is, can we use technology in a manner which promotes a human civilization as opposed to an inhuman?
Right.
And I would say in the last 20 years, technology has been used for the forces of inhuman more than human. Now, it's clearly it's been both. Anyway, so controlled
right.
demolitions are coming. We talked about pension funds. We also have insurance companies that have been hit hard by the drain from the various strategies in the government mortgage market, but then by lower interest rates. So we see insurance companies leaving the long-term care industry or failing. Obviously,
right.
we see a lot of insurance companies leaving Obamacare.
Right.
And one of the stories I mentioned was a second Zurich insurance executive committing suicide. And you wonder, oh dear, what do they know that we don't know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, and then of course there's bankruptcies. So it's very interesting. If I've been looking through the portfolios and businesses of many of the different people who've been nominated or will be nominated by the new administration for cabinet and probably sub-cabinet positions. And one of the things you're seeing, Joseph, is that many of those businesses are businesses that were harmed both by the diminution of the middle class and Obamacare grabbing such
right.
a big portion of middle class discretionary income. And I
right.
think one of the reasons that Obamacare is so high on the list is, you know, you have this whole world of businesses that have been slaughtered by the
right.
the grab of discretionary income. So,
this is another crucial thing, and I think Obamacare is going to be. We've already heard indications from Senator McConnell that it's going to be front and center when Congress reconvenes. Trump obviously ran part of his campaign on the repeal of the thing. I think what we can expect to happen, or my way of approaching it, if I were in Congress and in a position of leadership within the Congress, would be to repeal the penalty aspect of Obamacare, which effectively repeals Obamacare. It leaves it sort of in place, but it rips the guts out of it. That one act alone would put a lot of discretionary income back in people's pockets. And again,
right.
you know, I go back to my model that Trump, being a real estate developer, heavily involved in the casino business, you know, I was in the casino business myself, and I know people to this day that are still in it out in Vegas and other places in the country, and they've been hurt very, very badly
right.
by the whole thing. And it's a measure of people not having the discretionary income. And I think this is a reflection, too, of what we see happening in consumer confidence being restored. I think people are sensing that they're going to have the discretionary income that they used to have before that fiasco was foisted off on us. Thank you, President Obama and Nancy Pelosi. I think that's part of the reason you're seeing a rebound. Now, that could evaporate, you know, if Congress does nothing or just tinkers and fiddles with it. But for the moment, I think it's front and center on the new administration's agenda.
So the second point after controlled demolitions was something I've been talking about all year. But as I talk with subscribers, I continue to find that they still don't necessarily understand the importance of this, and that's the debt growth model
mm-hmm.
is dying. We have
mm-hmm.
gone through a period of not only explosive increases in debt, but the cost of debt dropping. So
mm-hmm.
interest rates have come down literally for 3.5 decades, and now it looks like they're starting to turn up. And so
right.
it means we've had cheap capital for decades and decades and decades, and now our capital, instead of getting cheaper this year, is starting to get more expensive. And that is a, you know, there's so many people who are alive who've never lived in a world where the cost of capital was rising. They don't know what that world looks like. They haven't experienced it. They don't even realize they've been in a world where the cost of capital has been falling.
Right, right. You know, I tell people that raise the issue with me, think back to the days of Nixon and Carter. You know, if you want to know what that world was like, because that's literally what we're facing. But there's something else that you put in that section that I think is very important to talk about, and that's the war on cash. You have a number of stories there about the Indian government confiscating, as we saw Prime Minister Modi do recently, taking out of circulation large denomination rupee notes and so on and so forth. I suspect that there's some geopolitics behind the scenes going on here as well, because if we turn the clock back a couple of years, you'll recall that Iran and India made a mutual bilateral currency swap arrangement for India to buy Iranian oil in rupees and bypass the dollar completely. And we've seen a number of other of these types of bilateral currency arrangements emerging as the Shanghai BRICS bloc was attempting to kind of bypass the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. I suspect that what that move in India was pressure from Washington, from the Obama administration, to make that move. It literally robs India of the ability to conduct their trade with Iran and be a part of that emerging bloc in the Chinese Silk Road project. It takes the ability for them to trade with Iran in rupees away from them. So there's something going on. I'm almost certain of it behind this Indian move. I don't think this was really coming from New Delhi. I think this was pressure being put on them.
No, if you look, there are two links in the War on Cash section on the web presentation that describe coming out of the January 2016 Davos meeting.
Yes.
Suddenly, within 30 days, you have multiple countries' institutions moving against cash.
Right.
And it's clear, and it's interesting because there was a guy used to work at Davos who said, you know, everybody at Davos loves government because they can always think of government, more ways for government to spend money, to make their businesses money.
Right, exactly.
And what I think is, if Davos is going to keep their, print money, get rich schemes going, they're going to need to, have more control over the economies. I think this is an issue where, with the debt growth model sort of dying, they're trying to drive the model deeper into the cash flows so that they can find the juice to keep their game going.
Yes, exactly. I do too.
This is more central control. And if you look at what's going on in India, it's funny. I just saw some big Harvard expert saying that what Modi had done was genius, and it was the genius of great monetary policy. From everything I can see, he's destroying the economy.
Oh, yeah,
he's literally
exactly.
Shutting down. Right, and
yeah,
people
exactly.
are having to go
yeah.
back to barter with rice, and, there's huge growing unemployment from it. I mean, to me, it's a complete disaster.
Well, it is a disaster,
and
it's going to do something else, I think, in India besides barter, and that inevitably you're going to see local currencies arise. I mean, we've discussed this before. There's always going to have to be a physical medium of exchange just simply for day-to-day transactions. I mean, it's ridiculous if you go to your local grocery mart to buy groceries or whatever, that you're going to, log in and pay them in Bitcoin and electronic
right.
transactions, because at a certain point, people are no longer going to trust that. So, yeah, I agree with you. He's taken a step there that clearly is being dictated not in India's interest but from somewhere else, and it's going to rebound against his government. Anybody trying this, I think, is going to find out very quickly that their political futures are going to be severely limited. And I expect it to happen this year in India, quite frankly.
Well, the thing I want to bring this back to you and me, because what this means is, whether it's pension liabilities or just having built up a greater overhead than you could really afford because there was so much debt money either
right.
happening at the federal level and coming down to sort of by the states and local areas politically, or bond deals being done at the state and local level. During this period, I think everyone has built up overhead that is not economic.
Right.
And so there's going to be pressure on governments, whether federal, state, or local, to try and keep that overhead funded with more parking tickets, speeding tickets, fees, licenses,
right.
fines, and where that goes negative. I mean, one of the reasons it's really important to turn the government money to a positive return on taxpayers, where that thing goes negative, it can really spiral down and destroy any economy, whether it's in America or India.
Right.
So it's something we all need to watch out for as we go through this change. It's
well,
how are we going to re-engineer everything? Yeah.
Well, the other thing it's going to do is, if they pursue that path, eventually, as you say, they're simply going to run out of money. And fees and so on are not, and parking tickets are not going to be able to sustain the bureaucratic infrastructure. So, you know, you could be looking at a meltdown of local and regional governmental structures as well. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot to be wary of with this cashless policy. It's just not going to work. You know, they may try it.
My fear is not that they melt down. And we saw in Indiana an entire police department quit and leave the town with no police department. It was impossible to implement responsible policy, given sort of some of the issues going on, including financial. But another story that didn't make it into the final cut, but I was tempted, was you know those radar handguns that they use to sort of get people on speeding?
Yep.
They're using them in France to hand out fines for speeding bicycles.
Oh, jeez.
They're now using handguns. And if you're speeding on your bicycle, you're going to get a ticket in the mail.
Oh, for crying out loud.
It's funny, but it's not funny. Okay, but clearly the debt growth model is over, and that means the centralizers are going to be looking for more money. So there's a predator, you know, out there in our midst, and we all need to be wary and make sure we're prepared to duck the consequences. And that one practical thing I can say is I think it really behooves you to know what the unfunded pension and healthcare liabilities are for your state and local government and what it means to your pocketbook and your property taxes. So
hear, hear. Yes, absolutely.
Another thing I wanted to mention, and this is particularly with Trump talking about rebuilding America, we're seeing the U.S. dollar just skyrocket. You know, it's been strong since the summer of 2014, but it's broken through the $100 ceilings, and it could head, you know, if you look at where it's headed, if you look at the charts, we could be talking about 106 or 110. That has the possibility, you know, during the bailouts, we had a lot of the emerging market countries borrow lots of dollars. We've been very liberal with loaning dollars. Now that interest rates are rising, and if we're pulling the dollars back to North America, is that going to put them in a dollar bear trap?
Yep. Well, I think so. And the other problem here that is going to be yet another bumpy, bumpy road, at least through the next year, if not longer, is if the dollar remains strong, well, then how do you reshore the manufacturing, which clearly Trump has made an issue. He made it an issue during the campaign. After the election, of course, he went out and talked Carrier into staying in the United States. Well, you know, how do you mix these two things together? It's going to be very interesting to see if he can come up with a solution to that.
Right.
This is the problem. We're in such uncharted waters in just about every area of the four quadrants that you mentioned that it's no one, you know, we're reading tea leaves. You know, how is all of this going to work? And, you know, it's true. And the problem is, part of it, Catherine, is I think everybody's got to be prepared for what I call the dissolution of ideological labels. You know, we can no longer talk in terms of Keynesian solutions or laissez-faire solutions, because we're really trying to feel our way forward to some sort of new paradigm for financial and economic organization, and no one, I don't think, really has a clue as to what's going to go on. So it's going to be rather bumpy, and solutions in one area might not work in another. And this is going to make, I think, his first administration rather bumpy, and it's certainly going to be even bumpier outside of North America. So it's going to be a very, very interesting time period.
One of the things I published today, along with News Trends and Stories Part 1, we had our wonderful graphics designer make cartoon characters for three of the characters that we talked about when you and I did the Trump transition, which was the Titanic Turners, the pigs, and the Scaredy Cats. But we also added a fourth character, which is the Scorpions. So let me go through this again. The Titanic Turners are the people who say, you know something, I'm going to take responsibility. I'm going to try and see if I can't turn the Titanic in time. I'm going to see if I can't make things work. And then you've got another person who says, you know, this is nuts. I'm going to take my money and run as far away as I can.
Right.
And that's the scaredy cat. And then the pigs are like, how do I make money out of this situation? So you and I talked during the Trump transition, if what happened in Russia when the wall came down, basically the pigs got control and it went out of control and the place got raped.
Right.
And the Scorpions, I added the Scorpions because I realized, you know, a lot of people are pigs who, because they think that's the effective strategy, but they can certainly be incentivized with carrots and sticks to become Titanic Turners, or certainly to help the Titanic Turners, or to, you know, make their money doing things that are good for everybody. So,
right.
So I think one of the most important things we need to do is make a pathway for them to be successful as Titanic Turners and, you know, to do better as Titanic Turners. But the Scorpions, you know, it's a scorpion and it has a face that looks kind of like Dick Cheney. But the Scorpions, you know, there's no point in talking to the Scorpions. You just got to keep them in a cage. You got to keep them in the corner. I know you know the story of the scorpion and the frog, because they will do things that are self-destructive just because, you know, they love to destroy.
Yep.
And, you know, that's what they know how to do. It gives them juice. So anyway, but I think part of when we talk about the variability, you know, the key issue in your town is who's going to get control. Is it going to be the Scorpions or the Titanic Turners?
Right. Right. And, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic on that point because this last election, you know, I'm one of those people that still thinks that Trump probably did win the popular vote. There was so much illegal voting fraud being committed for Hillary Clinton. And we'll get to that later because I have some things to say on that score. But I'm cautiously optimistic simply because there was such widespread support for Trump from just almost every demographic group that you can think of. He really put together a very different kind of political coalition at the grassroots level. And what I am kind of optimistic is that he's continuing that kind of direct use of social media since the election to communicate, you know, little sound bites or little thoughts and so on. In other words, he's continuing to stay in contact with that group of people. So just in terms of sheer numbers, I think that the Titanic Turners, although they, you know, us ordinary people might not be the rich and powerful, I think that there's enough mass there that the Titanic might in fact turn, but it's got to be sustained. And I think that's one reason that Trump has been hammering away continually since the election through the social media outlets, tweeting and so on and so forth. So I'm cautiously optimistic there.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons he wants Bannon in the White House, because he wants to have a way of communicating which is very immediate and direct, and he wants to continue that.
Right.
Yeah, we definitely get to that because we have a lot to say on that. I want to talk, one reason I think the dollar is going to continue strong is there's some real issues now about the future of the dollar, and we'll talk in geopolitics about the European Union. But it's fair to say that we have big elections coming up in 2017.
Oh, boy.
And
that,
you know, so you're looking at that and you say, what happens to the European Union? Well, if you can't answer that question with confidence, how are you going to deal with what in the world's going to happen to the euro? We see the euro almost at U.S. dollar parity now.
Right.
So it's almost there. And then I also, two other things I wanted to mention. One is inflation. We did a great Salieri report with Charles Hugh Smith, who made his case that inflation is running in the United States at 7%, and then John Williams, the shadow stat, came out slightly after that and said his calculation was 9.2. Now, the official calculation shows inflation going down to, I think, 1.2% this year.
Oh, geez.
So the spread, you know, the U.S. government, the shadow that spread is ever widening. But it certainly seems to me that that inflation has been quite significant for
yes.
the average consumer, both in Europe, well, in the developed world. And I think if you look at the cost of capital going up, Joseph, that's likely to continue, particularly part of the debt growth model being over is that when you issue more paper and debt, instead of being able to float it around the world, it simply debases the currency, which creates an inflation effect.
Right.
So
right.
I don't know about you, but I think inflation is, inflation for staple goods is in our future over 2017.
Oh, yes, I totally agree. And I think we can add to that another possible scenario with the rising interest rates. You know, I mentioned Carter and Nixon earlier, and if you were alive at that period, you'll recall the expression stagflation, because that's what we were having
right.
back then.
Right.
And this is a real, again, this is another one of those variables in all of this that is going to be very hard to predict, because it's going to work against the kind of infrastructure projects that we've heard Trump mentioning from time to time. It's going to be a countervailing force against any efforts to increase productivity. So we're entering some very, very uncharted waters here. I don't know about you, but I haven't listened to any financial expert that really, I think, grasps the totality of all of this like you do. And that indicates to me that, again, we might be in a huge paradigm shift in terms of economic theory, in terms of fiscal theory, and so on and so forth, because no one, I don't think, really has a grasp on a wide enough data set really to make sense of all
right.
of this.
Right. So, and that brings us to the U.S. budget, because I think the number one challenge is, you know, there is a secret cash flow. You know, you and I refer to it as the secret dividend, but it's more than
right.
just a secret dividend. There is, talk about overhead, the black budget,
yes.
the hidden system of finance, the secret dividend. The covert side has a major tax on the overt economy that no
yes.
one is allowed to know about, no one is allowed to talk about it, and it's the 800-pound gorilla in the room, because how are you going to re-engineer everything to become more efficient, more productive, but still provide for that
mm-hmm.
enormous amount of covert? We need to come up with a name.
Like, yeah, we do.
The planetary rent. The planetary rent payment is due, and you know, it makes it impossible to go into the invention room and figure out how you make things productive when
right.
you can't admit that that's really there.
Well, this is where, again, I'm cautiously optimistic, because I think that Trump is an astute enough man in terms of looking at fiscal policy, at the numbers themselves. I think he's an astute enough man that once he gets in there, it may occur to him that there's an aspect of all of this economy and budgetary considerations that is not being adequately reported. And I don't think it will take him very long to figure that out. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we might actually have someone that is capable of understanding the fact that you cannot look at the overt economy, because you're only looking at 50% of the picture. There's a huge hidden aspect to it. And I think the clue here for me, Catherine, that this might be a possibility in the works was his refusal to buy the new Air Force One at the costs that were being proposed.
Right.
That to me was a clue that he knows, or he may know, I should say, that something is up with all of these inflated prices in the federal budget. So we may see over the next 2 years, I would imagine that between now and the congressional elections in 2 years, we're going to see more and more in the public arena this idea that there's aspects of the budget that we don't have a clue, and we have to get a clue if we're going to be able to manage our fiscal affairs wisely. I think this is in the cards. So in other words, what you and I have been talking at conferences and on our blogs and so on for the past few years, I think this is going to become much more of a mainstream topic of discussion in the next 2 years. And that's good. That's good. It needs to be done.
Well, here's the interesting thing. You have people on the covert side who are providing necessary operations and functions. You
right.
have people on the overt side who are providing necessary functions and operations. Now, maybe they can be re-engineered and made more efficient. Maybe they can't. What we do know is we have a ton of people on the overt side who are providing unnecessary functions,
right?
Even harmful functions. And ditto, I'm sure there's some on the covert side as well. But to a certain extent, you know, when Trump at the Army-Navy game decided to spend half the game sitting in Oliver North's box, I figured, okay, you know, my theory that, you know, the Matt Damon and Joe Pesci scene in The Good Shepherd, I said, you know, Joe Pesci just got his candidate elected to president, and he's saying, look, the guys who are doing the necessary hard work on the covert side are sick of paying for the people on the overt side who are completely unnecessary.
Right.
So I don't think, has Trump nominated a lawyer yet? I don't think there's a, I don't think there's one lawyer as much, is there? Except for White House counsel.
I don't think there is, and that in itself is very interesting to me.
Right.
You know, what's changing in Washington with Trump, and he gets poo-pooed a lot for this, but, you know, you don't have here a politician in any classical sense of the word. You have a businessman, and he knows how the game is played. He knows where the loopholes are. And more importantly, he's able to look at a ledger sheet, a balance sheet, and see if there's something wrong. You know, there's just going to be no way for the same old games and tricks to work. And this is why I'm fully expecting that in the next 2 years, we're going to see the black budget and federal finances come under much more scrutiny as people edge closer to the idea that you and I have been talking about for so many years, that there's a huge hidden aspect to financial
right.
affairs, and it's going to become more mainstream. And again, that's good, because what it's forcing out into the open is an issue that you and I have talked about so much, and that's the lack of transparency in these things. So
right.
it's going to be an interesting, for the Trump administration, it's really going to be an interesting policy wrangle, how to balance the need, the genuine and legitimate needs of national security on the one hand, and the genuine and legitimate needs for some financial transparency at
right.
every level, federal, state, and local, on the other. This is another aspect of the bumpy road, in other words, is what I'm suggesting is going to happen as
right.
we're going through controlled demolitions and everything else. This is going to be forced out into the open. It's inevitable.
Well, let me tell you why it's so bumpy. There is nothing uglier than a person whose success depends on privilege, but whose mythology says that they have earned it through performance.
Right, right.
That's about the meanest, orneriest scorpion you've ever met.
Oh yeah, and they're going to be and they're going to be very nasty over the next few years, and you know, but the problem is their power is diminishing, and the nastier they get, the more it diminishes. So yeah, it's going to be bumpy, but I think we'll get through it.
Right. Well, that turns to positive, negative versus positive return on investment. And that is, can we turn the negative return on investment to a positive return on investment? And can we start productivity growth? Labor growth has started to fall. I would say what I call human productivity has been falling for quite some time. And that's the question, can we turn that around? And I've been looking at that very long and hard for
for quite a while, Joseph, and the politics of this are remarkable. And what's interesting is most of the people I talk to are convinced that it's absolutely hopeless. And I think part of that is they don't begin to understand how extraordinary the opportunity is, how much wealth could be created.
There's going to be huge geopolitical opportunities that I want to mention when we get to that section. But yeah, I agree with you. And I think the other problem that people can't wrap their minds around still is the notion of human productivity. We're dealing with an intangible here. You know, people that go to business school or to economics school and study these things know that there is an aspect of the economy, the soft production, you know, the arts and
right.
so on and so forth, that don't really get counted in when you're dealing with you know, producing steel or automobiles or what have you. This is the area, I think, where we're going to see, by the nature of the case, we're going to see an explosive growth in human productivity. And the reason I say that is that if you look back at history, every time that humanity goes through these immense, wrenching cultural changes that change almost every aspect of our institutional paradigms, including finance and including economy, what happens in those periods is you see an explosive growth of arts as a form of human productivity, and in the form that people pay for these things. I think we're looking at that because it's going to be, the arts are going to be the natural way that humans express themselves as they're going through a bumpy road. So that, I think, is going to increase, but I don't think anybody, at least that I've looked at, is factoring this into their calculations of what's going to happen to the economy. And I think it's going to be huge. You know, I could be drastically wrong, but that's my take on things. And it could be that area that actually is the most stable area financially and economically over the next, say, decade or so as we work toward a new paradigm. I think that area is going to be crucially important just from a financial standpoint for people. I know more and more people, Catherine, that are supplementing their income precisely by going back and doing creative artistic things and getting
right.
out there and making people pay for it, you know. So
right.
I think it's
right.
going to be a huge increase.
Right. Well, that's kind of how you get together and reinvent your world.
Exactly.
You first do it with music and with poetry and theater. Yeah. I always, you know, I always wanted to do a Chautauqua, buy a bunch of school buses and travel the country, you know, doing impromptu and theater and stuff to help us reinvent our whole world.
Right.
So,
right.
Well, let's talk. So I think the opportunity, somebody once asked me to estimate globally what the current wealth was versus what it could be. And I said our current wealth was 1% of what it could be, you know, if we were willing to conduct ourselves as a civilized, you know, society.
Right.
If you just look at the waste, you know, we wrote one wrap up this year on productivity, but if you just look at the money that is spent to do things that make people unproductive, like war or surveillance, it's, you know, it's extraordinary amounts of money. Anyway, piratization. I do want to talk a little bit about piratization because I think it is one of the big risks we face.
Yeah.
If you look at some of the politicking in Congress, I'm particularly worried about where Congress may try and force things. Piratization is when you privatize something at a below market price. So you transfer an asset or an operation to a private sector where they're getting a windfall benefit because it's not done at market, or you're transferring a liability back into government, again, without providing a market compensation for it. And so you're using these changes to basically subsidize and create windfall profits to the private sector in a way that we know Congress loves to do. That's how they get campaign donations from capital gains to private investors, corporations, and private parties. And The reason I bring up prioritization, and I'm particularly nervous about it, is one, if you don't have a lot of experience in Wall Street and Washington, it's hard to figure out what's legitimate privatization versus what's prioritization. So it, you know, it's hard to kind of track and see and prevent. And needless to say, the pirates are paid millions of dollars a year to be very clever at figuring it out. But the thing that concerns me the most on this is we're seeing real pushes on the Republican side for a constitutional convention, which, you know, I think is a very, very bad idea.
Well, I'm in 150% agreement with you there. I think it's a colossally bad idea. Because, again, you know, my lesson from history is that the 1787 Philadelphia Convention, Constitutional Convention, they were supposed to have gone there and tinker with the Articles of Confederation. And what they gave us was a whole new constitution. Now, the current political class, quite frankly, is just too plain stupid. I mean, there's not a one of them that has the stature of a Hamilton or a Madison or a Jefferson that can think through the long-term political consequences of the proposals that the current political class would put forward. So I am totally in agreement with you there. This is a colossally bad idea because if they did this, I suspect that what you would get out of it is precisely some sort of constitution that would legitimize and legalize piratization.
Exactly.
At every level, not just federal,
yes,
but state and local.
Right.
So in other words, think of post-Soviet Yeltsin Russia on steroids.
Right.
This would be a disaster for the country. It would be a disaster for the world economy. There's no way I trust the Jeb Bushes and the Republican leadership that's pushing for this to come up with anything that would be a legitimately needed constitutional change for the welfare of the people of the country. No way. No way.
Well, we know depending on which estimate you use, we're up to $17 trillion of mm-hmm. missing money missing from the federal government.
Right.
And here's what you do for constitutional change. You enforce the Constitution, which we haven't been doing. There's a law that says you can't spend money that isn't envisioned in an appropriate act and approved by Congress. Now, that means there's at least $17 trillion documented by federal financial statements that has been spent or disappeared or misaccounted for in violation of the Constitution.
Right.
So if you want to do something, then enforce the Constitution and go figure out where that $17 trillion is and get it back. Because if you're going to have pension funds going through controlled demolitions because we don't have $2 to $4 trillion to make good on it, well, you know, that $17 trillion is 4 or 5 times more than what
right.
we can't make good on. So we can
right.
make good on it if we get that money back.
So, well, the other thing, go ahead.
Well, the other thing is if you're not going to enforce your Constitution, then clearly you don't need to change it.
Right. Bingo. I was just going to say. And the other thing that this brings us back to is an idea that we tossed around in the last quarterly wrap-up, and that is that if we as individuals really want to make a contribution, we need to start urging our states to appoint special district attorneys whose sole job is to entangle the federal government with
right.
federal mandates, you know, with all their financial mandates on states in litigation, number one. And number two, states need to start asserting themselves and put some of that federally mandated money in escrow accounts and demand an accounting for that missing money before they spend
right.
one dime. It's time for pushback for all of these bureaucrats and lawyers in Washington that have been getting away with this. So, number one, no constitutional convention. I think there's something like, you mentioned, 6 states short of a constitutional convention. That's number one. And number two, we need to have the states, particularly the states that are smaller, you know, that have been suffering under the thumb of New York and California and the big states, to start asserting themselves. Because things cannot continue as they are. We cannot, you know,
right.
It's like Senator Dirksen, the old senator from Illinois, I remember him very well, used to say a billion here and a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about some serious money, you know. So we've added three more zeros to the end of that statement. Now we're dealing in trillions. And it has to come to an end.
Well, it comes down to whether or not we pay our taxes in the end, and that's why I think the idea of tax escrows is very appealing to me.
Yep.
Because if the money that we are giving to government is being used illegally outside the Constitution,
yep,
and they refuse to obey the laws related to financial management and constitutional appropriation laws, then it falls down to us on enforcement. Well, I'm not a great believer in not paying your taxes, because I think they're legitimate things that we have envisioned. You know, there are obligations that government has that need to be met.
Sure.
And so, to me, if we're going to enforce the Constitution, you know, that's why I like the idea of putting your money in escrows. Now, I'm always told, oh, we would never be able to organize and get that done. Well, I think unless you organize to get that done, you're going to continually be harvested again and again and again. And at some point, we have an obligation to do something about it. So tax escrows, if there are any lawyers out there who want to help us investigate tax escrows, we'd love your help. So contact me at Ask Catherine. Okay, national security state out of control. Needless to say, since 9/11, one of the ways that companies have generated revenues and stock market value is to just create national security make work.
Yep.
And if you look at the expenditures and the contracts, I mean, it's basically out of control. And I think that's what you were referring to with Trump saying, you know, on his tweets on Boeing, which I loved, which is basically, you know, we want Boeing to make money, but not that much money.
Well, so. It's again, you know, you put it very well earlier when you said that we're really in a conflict ideologically between the inhuman and the human. And
right.
As you also put it, the national security apparatus that you know, George Bush put into place and that Obama has expanded is really a drain on production. This is a non-productive activity. It doesn't do anything.
Right.
It gives these people a paycheck, and that's about it. But, you know, that's a very lousy way to circulate money, and it's certainly not a way to circulate money to generate any sort of actual human productivity or hard
right.
industrial productivity. The thing that interests me about the Trump statement about Air Force One, you know, that, you know, we're not paying that much for this aircraft, is if you look at the American military expenditure, things like Air Force One, and I'm thinking too of the F-35 fighter, this big, you know, now multi-trillion-dollar boondoggle for a plane with very poor performance characteristics. If you look at the USS Zumwalt, you know, this ugly-looking, newfangled Navy ship that doesn't work. You look at the aircraft carrier Gerald Ford that's having problems. What we're seeing is what we're getting, again, a lousy return on our investment for hugely expensive weapon systems that don't work. You can't tell me that Russia spends the same amount of money to get an equivalent weapon system. It's just not there. This is the other thing the administration is going to have to look at, and I suspect that if they're really going to look at this and examine it in a comprehensive way, they're going to have to look at the whole structure of the way contracts are bid and awarded. The way it's currently structured favors these big defense companies, and if they really want to get a return on investment, they need to open up the whole bidding process and make it transparent, you know, make it a genuine bidding process.
I'm going to be much more difficult because I've dealt with government contracting a lot in my career. I think, first of all, you have a much larger bureaucracy than you need doing the current functions.
Yes.
So, you know, when I first took over the FHA, I did a calculation and figured I had 7,000 employees and I could run the whole thing with 250.
Yep.
So there is, you know, we have a very paperful federal, state, and local process. And while companies have been re-engineering for 30 years, government has done remarkably little. And that's
right.
Because we've been soaking up, as corporations have been laying off, government has been expanding employment to kind of create jobs. So part of that is, but here's the other thing. If you look at let's say you and I were to downsize the bureaucracy as dramatically as we wanted, you know, the thing I would say is there are plenty of government jobs for those people, because what we need is we need to stop using the contractors who are selling goods and services to the government to control and operate the government information and payment systems.
Yes,
we need,
here.
You know, we need long-term civil service to do those jobs. So I, for one, think it is a terrible conflict of interest for the government to concede its sovereignty to private banks and private corporations. I think there needs to be, you know, if we're going to have a sovereign government and we're going to pay taxes to have a sovereign government, then we're going to need to get private corporations and banks out of certain functions. We're going to have to re-governmentize in all these different areas. So,
oh, I totally agree.
Right.
And this is the flip side of the coin here, Catherine, as to why the Constitution is not being followed. Because
exactly.
Corporations don't have to follow it.
Right.
So the other thing, you know, I think that the Trump administration is going to have to do in order to make return on investments to the taxpayer positive is to go in and restructure the government precisely along the lines that you suggested, to restore sovereignty to federal agencies. And this is going to have to happen at the state level as well, where you see
mm-hmm.
much the same thing going on. You're going to have to do that, and for the sole reason of restoring sovereignty. But again, when that happens, I think you're going to see a return of constitutional function. So this is the other thing. If you take the corporations out of that mix, you're also curtailing the power of the lobby groups in Congress. Congress is going to have to step up to the plate and be a Congress again, rather than a special interest group of people shelling out privileges through legislation. So, you know, Trump has to have a comprehensive view. And there are certain signs, you and I have discussed this before with John Rappaport, there are certain signs that some of his appointments are kind of leaning in that direction. So, you know, if he doesn't succumb to the piratization impulse, I think it could be a good thing. But it's got to be a comprehensive thing. And again, that's going to take,
right.
I would imagine, if that's in the cards. You know, Reagan tried it and failed. But if that's in the cards, it's going to take at least two administrations to do it and to do it effectively. So, again, it's going to be a bumpy ride.
So here's why I think that change is inevitable, and that's because what we saw in 2016 was a lot of different symptoms of cut and run.
Yep.
We saw Lockheed Martin spin out its information and payment systems division to a smaller company that SAIC had set up for that purpose to spin its out to. That's an enormous control position, and if Lockheed's willing to give up that kind of control position, what it tells me is the liabilities have reached a point when they're willing to give it up.
Yep, exactly.
We also saw, you know, we saw an enormous amount of record mergers and big mergers in 2016, but one really stuck out in my mind, and that was Bayer buying Monsanto. And
oh, yeah.
As you know, this at the same time the Department of Justice was squeezing both Volkswagen and Deutsche Bank. And to this day, my question is, were the Americans trying to get the Germans to buy them out and protect them from the liabilities on Monsanto which I think at this point are potentially enormous.
Oh, yes, I do too. And I'm so in agreement with you there, Catherine, because I have a blog coming up in a couple days. Actually, it'll be up by the time this airs. But in the last 2 weeks before the new year, there were some astonishing stories about GMO backlash, what I've been calling GMO
right.
geopolitics. There was a paper published in Nature questioning the whole concept of substantial equivalence, which is the concept that was put forward by Monsanto and some of these agribusiness companies and then picked up by the FDA under George Herbert Walker Bush and used as a way for them to leverage the acceptance of GMOs on the basis of some very wanting corporate science. That paper was followed by bans in Italy, I believe. Russia, within days, proposed to the Eurasian Economic Community a labeling law, GMO labeling law. A federal district court overturned that decision, I think, in Hawaii. And basically, the decision of the federal court was, yes, localities do have the legal right to determine what can be grown and not grown and what they want and don't want and what they want to label and don't want to label. So the backlash against GMOs is growing. So, yeah, the Bayer buyout and merger of Monsanto, I think, is very, very suspicious here, because if this continues, there are going to be all sorts of lawsuits. And it's going to be in the form of class action against a lot of these agribusiness companies, and Bayer can be left holding the bag. So I think you're seeing the beginning of a rush away from GMOs. And the other interesting story here that emerged in those last 2 weeks was a province of China, the province of China that actually borders Russia, in fact, passed a provincial legislation that was very, very severe on GMOs and contrary to the policy in Beijing. So the revolt is growing, and to my knowledge, the central government in Beijing has not overturned that provincial legislation. So it's growing everywhere, and it's going to hurt these big agribusiness companies. So I think your reading here is correct. I think it's kind of a form of long-term economic warfare against Germany by letting that merger go through. I'm very suspicious of that whole thing.
Right. Well, there are many other signs of cut and run. I only put up a few of them, but what it tells me is everybody's getting ready for the next phase, and they
yep.
don't want liabilities hanging over, because 2.0 is coming into the end game, and they don't want to be liable for anything in that end game. So
yep.
change is here. One of the things that's most cutting into productivity that you and I have talked a lot about is corruption. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on corruption, but I think, if there's any difficulty we face in the developed world, it's how in the world are we going to shift out of corruption into, productive governance, leadership, and society, because the corruption is everywhere. It's top to bottom. But I think the example I wanted to use, because it was so extreme, was pedophilia. There's been
yep.
an enormous amount of headlines this year about pedophilia. The number of people arrested for pedophilia globally or just in the developed world in the last year has been, just rolls your mind. You have all sorts of scandals coming up. But, of course, what's come out so far from the Anthony Weiner laptop has been unbelievable. I mean, it's, because the when people say this has reached epidemic proportions, it really has reached epidemic proportions.
Yes.
And it's been hard for many people to fathom that this is really going on. And so one of the questions I have, will 2017 be the year when, you get a more widespread understanding of how bad this epidemic is? I don't know the truth, but one of the things is I'm watching Congress steadily try and pull out the rug from under the new administration. It sure looks to me that Anthony Weiner laptop and the related control files have too many people in Congress compromised. So
I would agree with that, and I would add my own suspicion, Catherine, has always been that these local stories of pedophilia are linked. The problem with the Anthony Weiner, you know, the whole Anthony Weiner Pizzagate complex is that what it is suggesting is something that I've long suspected, and that is that this is a global phenomenon. It's a global network. So in other words, it's not just this locality or that locality experiencing it. It's everywhere.
Right.
There is a deliberate entity or force or something, whatever you wish to call it, behind all this. And I think that it's getting to the level that this aspect of it cannot be ignored anymore. And I suspect you're right, that this is the reason you see the Congress, as you say, trying to pull out the rug from the Trump administration. Because quite literally, they have no leverage of that sort, at least from what we can see now. They have no leverage of that sort against Trump. So this makes him quite literally a maverick, a loose cannon that they cannot control in this respect. I think you're going to see in the coming years and beginning this year, I think you're going to see more and more of a focus on this. And I think that it's going to get to the point that whether he wants to or not, Trump may have to appoint or order the FBI to make a major investigation into all of these things. I think at this point it's just not going to go away. We've just seen a story in Canada about a roundup of a pedophile ring. There have been reports of this in Norway and so on and so forth. So it's everywhere. There's going to have to be an international effort here, I think, to clean all of this out. It's something that we have to get rid of if we're going to restore some confidence and trust in the government. And that's the other thing that we're facing here. You know, we've seen this whole business with the corporate-controlled propaganda media organs just shooting their trust and confidence in the foot during the last election cycle. So that basically trust in government and corporate institutions is at an all-time low. So are we going to believe anything that they say anyway? This is a real epistemological, philosophical problem that Trump is facing. I think this is part of the reason that he's continuing his use of the social media to make direct contact with people and bypass that whole swamp to begin
right.
with. I think that he's under some extraordinary pressures, and that he knows where it's coming from and why it's coming. And this I really do think is partly behind why he's kept that whole thing going. I don't know how he's going to deal with the corruption. It remains to be seen. Like you and I and John Rappaport discussed in our conference call previously. He's made some interesting appointments. I think Carson at HUD is a sign that he knows how deep the corruption is and that he means to do something about it. I think that's a good sign. We'll see.
Well, I think, you know, he's still going to have a black budget. There's no way you're going to shut that down. But
right.
I think whatever the constituency behind Trump is, they're sick of the waste. And, you know, they may not be on board to end all the corruption, but they may be, you know, certainly they're on board to end the waste because they know you can't keep that going. But my guess is that Trump's going to use his access to the Anthony Weiner laptop information to get his agenda through Congress. So,
yep, I think so.
You know, the other guys have control files, but now he's got a copy of a lot of control files. So,
yep.
You know, he's going to try and play it bottom up, not top down. But if he can't play it bottom up, then he's you know, you're right. Then I think he goes public. Okay, well, let's turn to Global 3.0 Rising. So this, you know, last year it was very focused.
Are we skipping voting fraud? Because I had a couple of things I wanted to say there.
Yeah, let's touch on voting fraud.
Yeah, you had an interesting article that you linked there. The first one there, a soft coup attempt, furious Trump slam, secret CIA report that Russia helped him. I have to be honest here, Catherine. I never bought into the Russian hacking meme to begin with because, you know, I've said over and over again, Russia had no good reason to hack the election. The risk was too high for them to do that. And the reason is that, you know, Russia clearly wanted Trump over Hillary. And if they were caught, you know, this could rebound against them in a major way. So I didn't see any good geopolitical reason for them to assume that risk. And the other problem here is we haven't really seen much proof that they did, other than, you know, a few URL addresses in Russia. But, you know, hackers are sophisticated enough to use fake addresses. The other problem I have here with this whole hacking meme is we're not told what kind of hacking the Russians really did. And in the absence of details, I just have to think that the evidence is so flimsy that there's no that there's nothing to this story. So it's another soft coup attempt here. I just don't see this. This is just more evidence of the corruption, really, that we just got done talking about, rather than anything else. And the problem is, I think it's also a bit of misdirection because, you know, the recount things that Jill Stein launched, you know, kind of backfired because in most of the recounts, right, Hillary ended up losing votes. And I think the real key question here is California. There was a California lady at one of the polling stations that noticed a huge amount of what appeared to her to be voting fraud, and we do know that millions of illegals voted in the election. I suspect strongly that California may not have been the strong Hillary state that they're making it out to be, and that they need this as a way of deflecting attention from the fraud that occurred for Hillary. She may not have won the popular vote. And if indeed her support in California is soft, you know, that's such a Democratic stronghold. They've got to keep that by hook or crook, and I think they'd be willing to lie to do it. So this whole corruption meme for me is not just confined to the pedophilia stories that we've seen last year. It's also hovering around the election and the fraud that took place during the election. I think her support was much, much softer than even the final results show. So, you know, this is something I expect, Catherine, that we might see the Trump administration start looking into once it's in office. It's going to do so very quietly, but I fully expect that the Department of Justice under Trump is going to start looking into some of these things, you know, the Clinton Foundation, the voting fraud, Wienergate, and all of this. And if that starts to happen, again, it's like you say, he's got some control files now on Congress, and that will be another pressure point that he can use.
Well, but here's the problem. Traditionally, well, both sides have been terrible on the voting fraud for decades, but the Republicans really were in the lead on computer voting fraud.
Oh,
until the Clintons sort of came up to speed. You know, the Clintons got the Democrats back in the game. I watched the voting fraud in the primary very closely, and the primary voting fraud in California, I believe Bernie Sanders won the California primary.
Oh, I absolutely do too.
Right.
And this is why I think California was soft for Hillary and that they've got to cover this up. Because with all the support that Senator Sanders had there, and with all the Sanders supporters, many of whom went for Trump, you know, I tend to think that there is a lot more going on in California. But again, this is going to be a stick that Trump can use, you know, not just the control files, the Wienergate control files, but also the use of the Department of Justice and launching investigations into some of these things. And, you know, everybody stands to lose if he does that. You know, as you say, you've got the Republican elite involved in the same thing. Just think back to the year 2000. So, yeah, this is another big stick that he can use to go after some of this corruption.
One of the things I do want to mention is we'll talk when we get to geopolitics more about the Russian accusations, but what the, if I understand the White House correctly, they are accusing the Russians of hacking the DNC.
Yeah.
If you look at, and providing the information to WikiLeaks, if you look at the information provided to WikiLeaks, we have a retired British ambassador who said that he was the intermediary between the whistleblower. He said it was basically an inside job. You know, or inside to the Americans. So he was the intermediary. So we have him giving the equivalent of an affidavit in public on the record, and we have WikiLeaks on the record as saying they did not get it from the Russians.
Right.
So we have absolute evidence that the accusation is false,
right,
from reputable parties on the record, but we have no evidence on the record from the CIA, the White House, or anybody else as to what proof they have that I have been able to find. Right. So on one hand, you have a nebulous concept. On the other, you have hard testimony and evidence. The other thing we do know is that one DNC staffer who had access to the information was assassinated in cold blood in what appears to be a professional hit right after the DNC information, you know, went available to WikiLeaks. And we know that WikiLeaks put out a $20,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the assassin, which caught, you know, and that what subsequently followed was that Julian Assange's attorney was suicided and a few other suspicious things, including a cat burglar trying to break into the Ecuadorian embassy. So if you look at the fact pattern around the Seth Rich assassination, and the evidence given that, you know, as to how WikiLeaks got the information, I have to tell you the White House story looks like one of the biggest bluffs I've ever seen.
Oh, yes. It does to me, too. And this again, is why I wanted to talk about the voting fraud, because I think this hands Mr. Trump a huge political bit of leverage, because, you know, being in control of the Department of Justice, he can launch investigations now into all of these things. And I suspect, quite honestly, Catherine, that he's going to. And that's another reason that you know, they're trying to derail him as fast as they can, and I don't think they're going to be successful. He can launch investigations into all of this, and that could roll just about everywhere, you know, not just the Clintons. It's going to roll to the RNC, to the DNC. It's going to go everywhere, and it could catch a lot of people. And he can use this, just the mere
right,
threat of investigations, he can use as political leverage. So his political capital is very, very high. So I think we're going to see some resolution to some of these things. I certainly don't expect Mr. Trump to be the Messiah and go in there and make Washington, D.C. the shining city on the hill. But on the other hand, I do think that a lot of this corruption is headed for some difficulty. I really, really do.
Okay, well, more on this when we hit geopolitics, because I think you have a whole world of people who've been on the payroll who are not productive. And, and this represents one of their efforts to fight hard for their turf.
Yep, exactly.
Right. Okay, so let me turn to Global 3.0 Rising. A few things I wanted to note. We did this year in the wrap-up, we're focused on the end game in Global 2.0, because I think we've come into the real change in the end game there. But last year we talked about space. Here we go. And Joseph, I never in a million years when we did it, I never realized the explosion of space investment that would happen so quickly this year. But needless to say, there's much going on. We'll talk about more of it in science technology, but it's clear that space is now in the investment and financial world a very, very big business.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And there was an interesting story this last year that caught my attention, and that was Luxembourg. And we may have talked about this briefly in the last wrap-up, but Luxembourg has approved a law now that allows space companies that are based there to have the right to whatever they go out and find, and this is huge, because Luxembourg is kind of following suit of the Congress here in this country doing basically the same thing very recently. But what I find very interesting about Luxembourg is, of course, it's a banking hub. It's an international banking hub. So this means, the way I'm looking at it, Catherine, that the international financial community has more or less agreed that whatever treaties may say, this is what's going to happen in outer space, that corporations going
right.
out there and mining asteroids are going to have the right to whatever they recover. So this was a huge bit of news to me, and I fully expect that you're going to see other banking hubs following suit and kind of using the Luxembourg law as their own template for similar laws. So yeah, I'm in agreement with you. I think we've only begun to see the explosion of things happening in space, and there's other things that we'll talk about when we get to the science and technology.
Well, that means if you grab an asteroid and create a server farm on the asteroid,
right.
you can create an off-planetary financial jurisdiction.
Precisely. This is what I was getting at, and I've mentioned this before, is that, you know, Mr. Global appears for the moment to have been thwarted in their effort to build a global government down here on Earth, and I think they've changed their long-term strategy and decided to do this top-down, quite literally, beginning in space, and then drop it down to Earth. And this is the reason that we see all of these moves in legislative bodies in countries like Luxembourg that are big financial hubs. I think this is a trend. You know, that's what the story represented to me. It's the first of a trend.
Right.
I think we're going to see more and more of. I think you're going to see the same thing come out of the EU. And if the EU falls apart, watch for France and Germany to do this at lightning speed, you know, because they
right.
basically represent the European space program. So it's going to happen. You know, there's just no two ways about this. I think the other thing that the Brexit vote is presaging is we're going to see similar moves in Great Britain. And I fully expect the May government to do this, if not this year, within a very short period of time with their own legislative program. So this is going to spread. It's going to spread very, very quickly.
One of the book reviews that we did this year was Martin Ford's book, very good, called The Rise of the Robots Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. And we haven't seen a lot of discussion of this during the election for obvious reasons, but one of the policy issues we're all facing is automation is taking employment in the opposite direction. And we're seeing enormous waves of automation coming 2016 on out.
Right.
I just want to mention that. I think we're all sort of scratching our heads, not sure what that means. But if you're automating all the jobs at the same time you're cutting all the pension funds, you know, I keep scratching my head and saying, how exactly is this supposed to work?
Well, it can't work on a conventional model, I'm glad you mentioned the robots, because this brings us back to the human productivity aspect of things that we talked about earlier. If we're looking at the standard economic models of jobs, you know, Walmart clerks and so on and so forth, automation is quickly replacing them. I just went, you know, I try and avoid shopping at Walmart whenever I can, but I went in there a couple of weeks ago. Usually I shop late at night since I'm up at night, so I go to these 24-hour stores to avoid crowds. Well, I went into a local Walmart, 24-hour Walmart, and they had no human-manned cash register lane open. They had the self-checkout lane open only
right.
with one
right.
person trying to manage, you know, all nine self-checkout lanes. And what I think this means, Catherine, is that the human productivity that I talked about earlier in the arts is going to have to take up the slack. And no
right.
one's talking about this. No one is talking about this as a means of gainful productivity and as a means of making money. But I think that in a certain sense, we're going to have to do it, and in another sense, it's going to be necessary to preserving our humanity during this period. So it's going to be culturally driven, as I mentioned earlier, but it's also going to be driven by some hard economic reality. So it may be that part of our future economically is going to be, you know, the teenagers getting together with their rock bands in the garage and composing some songs and going out and performing them and making a little money. I think we're going to be looking at that kind of thing over the long term, and we're going to have to look at that sort of thing. And I think it's a good thing because
right.
it's going to also, you know, the arts have been traditionally a means of dissent, a means of critique of the social order, of the political order. So I think we're looking at, hopefully, you know, if things fall out as I'm thinking they might, we're going to be looking at kind of a revisitation of the 1960s with the explosion that we saw occur in music and in some of the other arts. This is the only way I can think out of this paradox that you've mentioned, because the only other alternative is a massive expansion of the welfare state.
I see tremendous ways out of this, as long as you're willing. Government has gone to great lengths to make it almost impossible for small business to start up and succeed. And that is a handicap which is government engineered. You take that off, and
right.
there are explosive jobs and income that can be created with small business, small organizations, including arts and culture. But you got to take that boot off.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I would much rather say you take the boot off than have a welfare state. But
me too.
But you know, the boot continues to pile up. Let me quickly go. 5G is coming, and with it, virtual reality is coming. So we're seeing, with the improvement of the technical bandwidth, a skyrocketing of both EMF radiation, but also the enormous multimedia and three-dimensional things that can be done with the technology. You know, I put up on the web presentation my favorite link of the whale hologram jumping out of the school gym floor. But needless to say, the ability to create and manipulate reality is just, you know, is headed onto steroids, and it's going to start this year. I wanted to mention that. I also wanted to mention surveillance capitalism, because the invasiveness of the technology just gets more and more just more and more terrible. It's funny, I was, every time I go to Europe, I go through all sorts of machinations to keep my smartphone working with a new SIM card every time I switch countries. And this last time I said, you know, I've so had it with this technology, I'm not going to bother. I'll just use Skype from a laptop to call, but I just won't even bother to have a phone with me, because I'm so sick of this technology and how invasive it is.
Yep.
But I notice the Facebook accounts keep going up, which I can't fathom. Anything you want to mention on those counts?
Well, yeah, I think the surveillance capitalism is another aspect of human productivity, because, as you say, not only is this really not productive in any ordinary sense. The other thing that, you know, robots can't produce art, robots can't produce music that's human, that appeals to us at a basic emotional and passion level. But the other thing about getting the boot off of small business, and I really do hope that Mr. Trump goes in there with an executive order, regulatory clean sweep, you know, and clear all of this stuff away to allow some small businesses to prosper. Because I would much rather shop at a small business that's locally or regionally owned, you know, or bank with a bank that's locally or regionally owned, than with any of these large corporations.
Right.
For the very simple reason is that, you know, they respect my privacy and I respect theirs.
Right.
I think if that happened, Catherine, if you saw the boot come off and saw some small businesses rise, I think you would see a consumer rush from people that are aware of how invasive and intrusive this is getting to be, rush to those types of businesses. I really, really do. I encounter more and more people that are just fed up with the corporate surveillance, not just government, but with the corporate surveillance.
Right,
they're
right.
just fed up with it.
You right.
know, this is why
right.
I hate shopping at Walmart and these big chains. I just don't like them. I just really don't.
The last thing I wanted to mention in the economic section was how will investors handle this much uncertainty? And without diving too far into it, when you look out at the scenarios over the next 5 years, we are talking about a variability in scenarios where literally you could see the Dow go up 50 to 100% or go down 50 to even more than 50%. So you're looking at extreme variability both in the economy and the corporate economy. And, needless to say, the difference between organized crime and corporate America is that corporate America, trades at a multiple of 10 to 20 times earnings because people believe that the rule of law is relevant.
Right.
If it doesn't, if everything's just organized crime, then it's going to trade at a multiple of one.
Yep.
So what I can't figure out, one of my unanswered questions is how do you maintain financial liquidity and leverage if everything is going to be lawless? So and it's one of the things that when you work with an individual investor, they're trying to figure out how to protect their assets from the lawlessness, and it's a big, big question mark. So I think one of the big questions is going to be how do investors handle the uncertainty? And it's one of the reasons I, for one, am glad to see business people in the administration. We need people who understand how unbelievably destructive some of these things are to equity, whether it's a small business or a big business. You know, frankly, the way to create equity in the society is to just stop destroying it.
Yes.
So if you can get people who understand business to engage with the citizenry to stop destroying equity, given the controlled demolitions, we've got to create a lot of equity fast if we're going to match, the liabilities that are being destroyed and the humans' productivity that's going to be destroyed by that. So.
Yes.
Anyway, so I would just make a plug for a little concern for the private investor. Well, that's the economy and financial markets. So needless to say, it sounds to me like we're coming into something more than just another year of slow burn. We're coming into real structural change here. Okay, so we're back for geopolitics. It's very interesting. We did the second quarter wrap-up right literally a day or two after Brexit. And
yep.
I remember, Joseph, you and I talking about how this was the story of the year. Well,
yep.
The year had hardly begun in geopolitics.
That's right.
So Catherine's bad call of the year was saying we should only spend 10 hours on the election. Because, you could figure it all out in the last week. Well, this election, interestingly enough, turned out to be something that really inspired a real conversation.
Yes.
There was real discussion of real issues. And if anything, I would say the big loser in the 2016 election was the corporate media. The corporate media, whatever credibility it had left, and from the Gallup polls, we know it was very low. It pretty much got destroyed.
Yeah, it
and,
did.
It really did. And I think that's one of the reasons we had a real conversation was the whole campaign conversation left the corporate media and entered into all sorts of independent media and direct intimate discussion between people. So
the way I look at it is that this election, and I said it, I think, in our second quarter review or at some point, this election was really a referendum. And it was a referendum on several things. It was a referendum on globalism versus national culture, or, if you will, multiculturalism versus national culture. It was a referendum on national sovereignty. It was a referendum on what financial model are we going to follow. Is it going to be finance capital, or is it going to be equity capital? It was a referendum on a lot of things, but yes, that definitely was, I think, a major part of it, Catherine. It was a referendum, really, on corporate-controlled media propaganda organs versus the new and rising internet media. And again, on all these counts, the global loony crowd was just drubbed. They were handed a resounding defeat. And yeah, you know, and I'm right there laughing with you too, because the other thing about this election, and it really began with the Brexit vote, and it was an interesting phenomenon to watch, because people all over the world were watching that vote and discussing it. So even though it was a vote that occurred in Great Britain, it was really an international vote on precisely the same things. It was a vote on their corporate media on versus the social media. It was a vote on globalism versus nationalism. In other words, all the things that Brexit was, the recent U.S. election was. And I think this is a huge clue as to what we're going to see happen this year. We've got major elections that we've got to watch coming up in France, then Germany, I believe, and the Netherlands. You know, these are all huge economies, and the rising opposition in those countries to the same sorts of things that we've seen here, the multiculturalism, the immigration crisis, and so on, are playing out in almost exactly the same way over there. And, you know, the Dutch courts convicted Geert Wilders of hate speech, which is, you know, just totally nonsense. And the only thing that really did was it made him rise rather dramatically in the polls. And, you know, the way I'm looking at this is I think we're going to see the same thing that we saw with Brexit and that we saw with the American election. I think we're going to see the same things play out in France. We've already seen indications, really, in France with Nicolas Sarkozy attempted to run again and capture the nomination of the French Republican Party, and, of course, was handily defeated. And Marine Le Pen, conversely, now, the last poll I saw in France, stands at about 44%, which is, you know, in French politics, that's huge. You know?
Right.
So it looks to me like Mr. Global is suffering everywhere. If Merkel wins her election attempt, Catherine, I think we're going to see a very weak government from her. And I don't expect it will last. It all depends, I think, on whether the Social Democrats are going to try and remain in her coalition government or if they're actually going to put up someone to run against her. Right now it's looking like they plan to stay in the Merkel government, but I suspect we're going to see some major policy shifts from her, and in fact we're already seeing signals of it. The German defense minister recently went to Saudi Arabia and just flatly refused to wear any, you know, Islamic garb or anything like that. So I think we're in for an interesting year geopolitically. I think we're going to see the same issues play out all over again in those European elections.
Well, I looked at it. There was one map I was looking at after because I was in Europe the whole time from the late October through the election. And it was amazing to me how intensely interested the Europeans were in the American election and how closely they were following it. And it shows you what a significant impact the federal budget and federal credit has on the entire global economy. It's not, you know, it's it is very much a global empire in terms of its financial and economic impact. And but what you saw when you unpack the numbers on the election was that the Democrats won Washington, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, Hollywood, and then the places that the Democrats had flooded with immigrants.
Yep.
And that's what they won. And oh, and people who were basically getting government subsidies, you know, in those areas. So you have the highly, you know, basically people on welfare in the urban areas and Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, Hollywood, and then the immigration they've swung in the last 10 to 15 years. And that's all they got. And if you geographically, if you look at the United States by acreage, now here's what's interesting. Wall Street, Washington, Hollywood, Silicon Valley all deal with products which are invisible that basically skims a profit from the work that the people who do concrete things. So the truckers, the farmers, the guys who do oil and gas, you know, the people, the grocers, any, the electricians, the plumbers, the people who do the concrete functions, who build the roads and maintain the bridges. All those four groups are skimming those people. You know, they're taking a skim.
It's a demographic trend we've seen growing in this country really since the first Clinton administration, where, you know, the so-called red counties and blue counties really show you the massive divide in the country, because geographically, by sheer land area, the country is predominantly red, but by sheer population centers and so on, you know, the blue counties hover and cluster in these little pockets around the country. But the interesting thing I think we're going to see, and again, we've already alluded to this, Catherine, earlier, is in our comments about the voting fraud, is that the traditional Democratic coalition, you know, the demographics that support the Democratic Party, I think are now incredibly soft, because you also saw people getting in the Trump campaign across almost every demographic group, young people, old people, women, minorities, and so on. It was really a huge change and shift, and I think this is also what they're a little afraid of, because they realize that they can't continue. And Bill Clinton himself came right out and said it during the campaign, that the
right.
Democrats can't continue to ignore the constituencies of the red counties, otherwise they're going to go down to massive defeat. And he even, if I recall correctly, President Clinton even advised Hillary to go to some of the states that she thought were securely in the Democratic column, you know, Pennsylvania and so on, and they turned out not to be. So, you know, they're in a world of hurt. The geopolitical aspect of this is what fascinates me here, because this election, I think, is going to rebound across the oceans. I really do. I think this is another reason
I agree.
To see the confidence that you find in France with people backing Marine Le Pen. I think it's the reason you see the confidence of people backing Wilders in the Netherlands. And I think this is also the reason that you see Angela Merkel looking like, you know, a sorry sack of potatoes every time she's on TV now, because she's having to change her policies faster than particles in the Hadron Collider. I mean, you know, and she looks to be doing this too, you know, but whether or not the Germans are going to think that this is a sincere, heartfelt change or just change for getting back in office, that's another matter. Like I say, even if she does, I think we're looking at a very, very weak government out of her in the future, and I don't even expect that will last. But there's something else you mentioned here in your introduction to the geopolitics here. And it's something I've noticed too, and I did my News and Views video on December 29th about this thing that you've noticed. You stated in what you sent me, assassination as a tool of statecraft was not to be missed in 2016. And I have to be honest with you, I think what we're looking at is what I've been calling a new international mafia war has just begun.
Right.
Because we've seen the murder of the Greek ambassador to Brazil, Mr. Amoridis. We had Yves Chamboulon, the NATO Auditor General, was murdered 3 days before Obama made his retaliation against Russia statements. And then 3 days after he makes that, we see the assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey. We saw the downing of the Russian airliner carrying the choir down to the Russian soldiers in Syria on Christmas Day. I think what all of this represents is that Mr. Global has now decided to start playing rough, and I think we're going to see, not that we haven't seen these types of covert operations before, but what makes this qualitatively and quantitatively different is the size and scale of it and the targets. Ambassadors right. are now fair game. And what I think this means is, number one, and I've said it for years, covert operations are a game that two can play. Don't expect the Russians or the Turks to sit back and take this lying down. That's number one. And number two, I think what you're going to see in the coming year, if not for a much longer period, as Mr. Global has resorted to these means to retain power, I think you're going to see what I've been calling a full-scale mafia war of international extent, and it's gradually going to not just snipe at the underlings in the family, so to speak, but eventually it's going to go all the way up to the capos.
Right.
This I think, is what we're going to see, and we need to understand a very, very profound thing here, if I'm correct in this high-octane speculation, and that is that this is going to transcend national boundaries.
Yes.
This is going to be something where the alliances are going to be peculiar. There was even a story that the Saker put out that was speculated on by somebody else, and I've put up a blog about this, that Russian GRU Spetsnaz agents may be running security interference for Trump. And I personally don't doubt this. Not that I'm thinking that Trump himself is personally aware of it, but rather that this is something that the Russians may be doing simply to protect someone that they think would be much more amenable to them than the Mr. Global crowd. So this is going to be a period where the alliances and patterns are going to seem very, very strange, because you have the global loony crowd in every one of these countries, and you have the national culture sovereignty crowd, I think, for want of a better expression, in all of them. And you're going to see some very, very strange patterns and alliances that are going to defy our conventional labels and modes of thinking over the next few years as we watch these international mafia wars play out. I really, really do think that this is a pattern that we've seen in the final weeks before the transition of administrations that is not going to go away. I think it's going to increase. They've tried everything else, and now they're trying this. And eventually,
right.
you know, by starting that kind of war, eventually they put themselves up on the target list.
You know, I look at this, I really do look at this from the prism of productivity. I think the national crowd is not just nationalist. I think the national crowd, if you look at the global crowd, they're sitting at their desks skimming, and nicest life skimming, and the national crowd is responsible to make sure things work bottom up, you know, and the trains can operate, and if the military gets sent out on a war, I think the military wants to make sure it can win. And they literally feel that the globalists are living in la-la land and are pushing policies that are not possible in the material world. They don't make sense in the material world. And they're watching productivity fall, and they're saying, you know, the time has come to assert adult supervision here, because this is not making any economic or cultural sense. It's just completely defiant of common sense. I think the globalists have just literally gone mad together. And
I'm in total agreement with you here. I'm absolutely in agreement with you here, because this is the other thing I think that we have to understand about these elections that have taken place, Brexit and now the American elections. I'm relatively certain we're going to see some surprises with the French and Dutch and German elections. You're looking at yet another contest that these elections represent, and that's between sanity and insanity, between humanity and inhumanity, as you've, I think, very, very astutely observed about all of this. This is really what the contest is about. And the global only people, by launching these kinds of covert operations, they've really done nothing but to paint a huge target sign on them. And we've discussed the other point about, you mentioned the hand of the deep state is becoming much more evident as the corporate media loses its influence. And this brings me back to the domestic aspect of this warfare, which is in large part ideological, obviously. And that is that there is a deep state faction, I'm quite convinced, behind Mr. Trump. It's not only the businesses that have suffered, from the loss of middle class discretionary income, but it's also a faction within the U.S. military that has been looking at these failed policies of the last 30 years, seeing essentially the same thing, seeing the waste in the federal budget and getting these weapon systems and paying billions of dollars for them that don't work. I think that there's a strong intelligence faction behind Trump, I think probably based in agencies other than the CIA, NSA and Department of Energy and DIA and so on. His military picks have been very, very interesting, because to me they represent this faction. Tillerson for Secretary of State, and on we go. This is deep state behind him. There's no doubt in my mind. So I think you're going to see this sort of thing reflected now much more on the international field. I think we can fairly safely assume that when we look at a France or the Netherlands or a Germany, that we're seeing similar deep state factions in those countries questioning the current leadership and its policies and adherence to the same global-only group of people that we saw behind Hillary Clinton. This is going to be a huge paradigm shift, I think, as we're restructuring everything. And the politicians that don't get it and can't move with that, they're going to go the way of Nicolas Sarkozy. They're going to go down in flames before they even get near an election.
Well, it's interesting. When the election started, I wrote violently against anyone. I was appalled that anyone would vote for Donald Trump, having lived in New York and shared the same PR communications company with Donald Trump. I was furious that anybody would seriously consider voting for Donald Trump. And then as the election went on, and, he continually made lots of sense. And then I would listen. The people who persuaded me to vote for Trump were the people who came out against him. And the more I listened to the establishment, it was the Republican establishment that persuaded me to vote for Donald Trump, the more I was appalled at their complete indifference to the harm that they had done to people all over the world, including in America.
Yes.
The stupidity and the privilege and the hubris of the American establishment was so, I've been lucky because I left Washington many, many years ago, and the hubris has done nothing but continue to get terrible. And I finally realized, if there's no way that you can change a negative return on investment system, then, let's blow it up. So it was Michael Moore that gave me the expression. He said, Donald Trump is a Molotov cocktail. I said, terrific.
Yeah.
Let's throw it.
Yeah. It's I had the same reaction to Trump that you did, Catherine. The more I listened to the opposition, the more I listened to the Republican elite and the Democratic elite, the more I thought this is an insanity that is born of hubris. It's living in its own virtual bubble, and they don't care what they do to other people. And ultimately, of course, that hurts them, because if they don't have people to sell their cars and iPhones and everything else to, then they're cutting their own throat. So the insanity of it is what gets me here. And we're seeing the same things in Europe. We're seeing, you know, Sweden is literally falling apart because of an insane policy that literally is insane. And we're seeing
right.
similar reactions in other countries. And Renzi in Italy suffering the constitutional referendum defeat that he suffered. The signs are all there. People are fed up. And I think that these factions that we see behind Trump, I'm quite certain that you see the same thing. Let's go back to the fact that prior to the Brexit vote, the Queen summoned the Vice Premier of Great Britain to Buckingham Palace for tea and dinner. Remember that story? And
yes.
she began to query the Premier, the Vice Premier, on the benefits of the EU. And it was clear that the Queen didn't like this. And I just stopped and thought, you know, well, this is the British monarchy here. You know, this is the most powerful and one of the wealthiest families, not only in Great Britain, but the world. And in the EU, what happens to their privileges? Well, they go right out the window. So I have no doubt that even very conservative institutions like the British monarchy are looking at these global-only policies and calling them out for what they are. They are anti-people. They're inhuman. There's nothing about them that make any sense. I think we're going to see some huge, huge upsets in the coming elections, particularly in France. If France votes Marine Le Pen in and Germany votes Merkel back in, I think the EU's days could be numbered. I really, really do. And the other thing that we need to note here about geopolitics as far as Europe is concerned, I have a lot to say about the Pacific too, so brace yourself. But the interesting thing, I just read an article, Catherine, that someone sent me from Germany about German businessmen doing a complete runaround of Berlin and continuing to do all sorts of deals with their Russian counterparts. And then a couple days later, someone from France sent me an article about how France is making all the quiet moves to start doing some real business with Russia once again. So in other words, there's little clues already that these European countries are going to bolt from the global-only agenda. What that means for the future of the EU is really the important question here, because like you pointed out earlier, if the EU does effectively become nothing but a paper entity, what does this mean for the euro? And if that happens and Mrs. Merkel doesn't get her trans-European army like she wants, and we all know who's going to be in charge of that, but if she doesn't get this, and under Marine Le Pen, I have my doubts, you know, she in that sense could be viewed as a traditional Gaullist. If this happens, then the euro is in deep, deep trouble. Deutsche Bank is already in deep trouble, and I don't expect the rest of Europe is going to rush to bail them out. So we may see a return to the D-mark. This may be the ultimate reason behind why Germany has been trying to repatriate its gold. There's just all sorts of ways this could play out. You know, we're reading tea leaves here, but I think the Merkel government is weak if it gets back in, and because of that, I think the EU is correspondingly weak. It's a shame that Great Britain doesn't have a stronger premier right now than Mrs. May, but Things are going to be very, very interesting in Europe in this next year. It's going to tell us a lot about where the direction of things is going to go.
We'll shift into the multipolar world. The one thing I wanted to mention before we finish the election is at the end of the election over Christmas time, I would notice that one of the top viewed videos rocketing through the internet was Trump's granddaughter speaking or reciting a Chinese poem in Mandarin. And I think it's very telling that Trump's grandchildren, who are also their grandfather is a billionaire and their father is a billionaire, but they are learning Mandarin at a very young age. And that, to me, that signifies a lot about where the world's going and where we need to go if we want to be part of it. So I thought I would mention that because I thought that was a nice little giveaway. Another thing is there was an interesting post by Robert Steele as a former CIA operative who sent a Christmas message to the new administration. And one of the things he pointed out was that it was a relatively small percentage of the electorate that voted for Trump. And it brings up the question, if we're going to get back to productivity, we have to find a way to build alignment. And I think the only way to do that is at the local level. And if we are going to get back to productivity, it means we're all going to have to start communicating it. And it's tough. I just came from a discussion of a local group, and there are deep, we're a population that's been worked over by a lot of different ideologies, and there's a lot of divide and conquer operations that have been going on, and people are still hurt and angry, and that's why I think it's so important that we get a better map of what's really going on. Okay, shift to the multipolar world. I was astonished this year to see Brzezinski come out with an article basically saying, okay, it's over. It didn't work. let's move on to a multipolar world. So even the people promoting the unipolar empire have given up.
Yep. It's more interesting to me. I mentioned Putin's warning, the full speech at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum in 2016, and you later mentioned the shift back to a kind of a Judeo-Christian basis of the civilization. I recently blogged. I put up President Putin's Christmas message. Have you watched that?
Yes, I have.
I would urge everybody that's listening to our discussion to go online and watch that five-minute little Christmas message that President Putin gave. Because it's very clear that he is trying to emphasize precisely those types of things. And he did so in a way that, and this is my point in bringing it up, he did so in a way that took direct aim at some of the phenomena that we've seen emerge in Western culture, particularly in the last recent administrations in this country and various governments in Europe in the last 30 years. He takes direct and deliberate aim at these trends. And to me, what this represents, Catherine, in terms of our big picture and the shift of the multipolar world and the geopolitics, is I've been saying for many, many years that Russia was going to play the soft power card. And we see evidence of this with the use of the Patriarch of Moscow to go around the world and meet privately with political leaders and so on. We've seen the Patriarchate of Moscow kind of emerge as the Orthodox equivalent of the papacy in so far as the use of it as a symbolic political soft power institution. Certainly, the Patriarch doesn't claim nor want any sort of papal powers or privileges or prerogatives or doctrine or anything like that, but we definitely see this pattern emerging. And what I think it represents, Catherine, is this is so incredibly Byzantinely clever of the Russians. what they're doing, as far as I can tell, is they are deliberately trying to appeal to more conservative and traditional cultural and political elements in the West that think right. more or less the same way. So again, you know, I go back to my international mafia wars. We're going to see some very, very strange alignments coming up, I think, in the next decade, where our conventional labels, and we discussed this earlier, where our conventional labels and attempts to pigeonhole people into various ideological paradigms, you know, Keynesianism versus laissez-faire capitalism, or right versus left, and so on and so forth, are going to become increasingly meaningless in this world, because we're watching international alignments taking shape that are very, very different than what we've been accustomed to. And Russia's playing this game very, very well. The other thing about Brzezinski that really kind of strikes me is not that he would just come out and state this, but more particularly, we've seen somebody else reemerge on the world stage here, and that's Mr. Kissinger. And this began a few years ago, you'll recall, when he went to Russia and made his statements in quite open and deliberate opposition to Brzezinski, that the United States had to quit demonizing Russia and start to try and coexist. And more recently, Mr. Kissinger has been reviving something that you and I have talked about in the past, and that's, you know, the Westphalian peace, the treaties that were signed at the end of the 30 Years' War in 1648. And it's interesting that Mr. Kissinger is deliberately invoking this image. What I think this portends geopolitically, as far as Russia is concerned, and as far as the possible foreign policy that we might see from the Trump administration, is I think Kissinger has it right. The United States is going to have to move very closely to Russia. In fact, get so close to Russia that it offsets China and that relationship. And I think we've seen certain moves in Russia and more recently in Japan that indicate that this might be in the cards, because, of course, we just had the Onsen summit between Mr. Putin and Mr. Abe in Japan. And the day after, they ink all sorts of billions of dollars worth of deals. I think this presages some huge geopolitical shifts in the future. I don't think Russia is going to abandon its relationship with China, but I do think that you're going to see the United States try to make up for lost time and move much closer to Russia in terms of trade and so on and so forth. And the soft power card here is going to be very, very crucial, because it's going to be interesting to see how Russia plays that and plays to the supporters, not only of Mr. Trump, but also in Europe, to the reaction against the immigration crisis there that you see with Marine Le Pen and Geert Wilders and so on and so forth. I think you're going to see some openings there with those groups, even if they do not obtain any sort of political power. This is a long-term.
Okay.
This is a long-term thing.
So let me ask several questions here, because the Brzezinski, you know, the grand chessboard theory was you throw up lots of blockages and you make sure that Europe and Russia don't get together.
Right.
And so that was basically the neocon strategy, if you will.
Right.
And now what we're seeing instead is bringing, in essence, the Judeo-Christian world back together again, saying, no, you know, we have more in common with Russia. Let's bring Russia, Europe, Israel, and the Anglo-American alliance back together again.
Right.
And that's a very different, it's a world organized around aligned cultures.
Right, exactly.
As opposed to geography.
Yeah, it's a world that's aligned, as you say, according to cultures, and that's a direct challenge to the global dream, you know, the global-only dream of their kind of engineered artificial multiculturalism, which has really, in my estimation, been nothing but an attack on Western civilization. And I think it's very important here that when we use the terms Judeo-Christian civilization, that we have to understand those terms in a philosophical sense that's composed of three basic fundamental elements. And I've emphasized this over and over again, but I think it's important to refresh our memory. The first basis of our civilization comes from the Old Testament and from the idea of covenant, from the idea of contract. And the nature of that covenant began the legal speculations and theories in the Middle Ages that have led to our system of law and jurisprudence, because, of course, that covenant is what a lawyer would now call an adhesion contract. In other words, a contract between two parties that are unequal in their power and status. It's not a normal type of contract, but nevertheless, the centrality of the idea of the freedom of individuals to enter into a contract and undertake certain obligations and obtain certain rewards for certain specific performance. This is basic to Western society. We wouldn't have our economy or even our scientific progress without this central notion. The other thing is, of course, Christianity and the fundamental role that the conceptualization within theology of the doctrine of the Incarnation played, because quite literally in Christian theology you have the Logos, which in Greek is an extraordinarily broad and deep term. It means not only mind, but it means rational principle of literally everything becoming flesh and dwelling amongst us. Well, this has huge metaphysical, long-term philosophical implications, because what it does is it breaks down the barrier, the old ancient idea that, you know, there are heavenly laws and there are earthly laws that the cosmos operates by. You've got a two-track system, but in that conception you're really saying that whatever is true scientifically or philosophically or metaphysically here is true in the whole universe. This is a profound metaphysical principle that allows the development of Western science. And the other thing that it sets up, the interesting thing, is that in Latin, this word, this Greek word logos, rational principle, can be translated by two words, verbum, which is the word that's used in the Vulgate, or at other times in Latin, it can be translated as the word ratio, in other words, proportion. It's a mathematical term as well. And the interesting thing politically that this concept at the core of Western civilization does is it sets up the idea of a reasoned faith. So in other words, you're setting up the possibility of a reasoned opposition, a reasoned disbelief in that principle, and therefore you're also setting up the potential for humanism, which is, for me, I think the third essential core to Western civilization, you know, the Renaissance humanism, when you begin the long philosophical process of the examination of some of these things, the free and critical inquiry. So there's these three components, I think, that are at the heart of our civilization. And if you look at the principles around which Mr. Globaloney has tried to engineer everything, they're completely artificial. They're completely inhuman. This is why we see the conflicts in Europe that we see with the immigration crisis. How can you import an unreconstructed medieval barbarism into the heart of Europe and expect it to adhere and integrate itself into your culture? Well, you can't. And Putin, it's interesting to me that Putin very deliberately, very subtly, in a non-polemical way, made each of these points the critical components of his Christmas address. So the soft power card, I think, is going to become an increasingly crucial central part of what we're going to see happening in the next few years, at least in the West, not necessarily everywhere else. But this is really at the heart of what we see going on in Europe with the opposition movements to all of this, because we need to understand that these movements aren't simply political, they're cultural. That's ultimately what they're about. Dutch want to preserve their Dutch culture, the French want to preserve their French culture, the Germans want to preserve their German culture. And Mr. Putin made it very clear that this isn't a crime.
You know, I saw it when I, because I've been in the Netherlands for a fair amount the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. When the Dutch say they want to preserve their culture, they're also saying it's very much related to also economic productivity, because the Dutch have a phenomenally productive, their culture is phenomenally economically productive. And if you look at the culture, I'll never forget with a Dutch friend going to, I just come in from Zurich on the train, and it was late at night, and we stopped at a store to get some fruit before I checked into the hotel. And it was a store run by immigrants, and they were very rude and very unhelpful. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, however well their store was going to do, if you behave that way, your store's not going to do anywhere near as well as it might. But it's very unproductive behavior. And my Dutch friend just rolled his eyes, and he said a Dutchman would never do that, which I agree. A Dutchman would never have done that. So
or
we're
a
not
Frenchman
just talking
or a
about
or an Austrian, exactly.
Well, a Frenchman might have.
Or well, maybe in
certainly
Paris,
a,
but not
in a Parisian, right? Not in the country, but a Parisian would have done it. So, but you know, there's an interesting, you know, this productivity thing is culture and economy are two sides of one coin,
right?
And I think part of it is true that if you're just like a business needs to operate on a model, a society needs to operate on a model. And if you have more and more people coming in who don't operate on your model or operate on a model which you find highly unproductive, that's a very big problem. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, again, getting back to Putin, it was interesting that in his remarks, he made it very clear that the attempt to demonize people that want to stand up for their culture, and he makes it very clear that this is the majority. You know, certainly there's tolerance for minorities and everything else, but he makes it very clear that minorities have to tolerate the majority. So, in other words, he comes very close to saying that, you know, it's not a crime to stand up for your national culture, and he made it very clear that Russia is going to do this. You know, so.
Right.
So I think we're looking at yet another kind of paradigm shift from this artificial model of multiculturalism and getting back to, and this is why I found Mr. Kissinger's remarks so interesting, is getting back to a Westphalian model. Because what that model in effect says is that you respect and honor the national culture. And that would include, of course, the religious preference, because this is what the Treaty of Westphalia did. You know, Catholic princes had to recognize the rights of their Protestant minority subjects and vice versa. So, you know, that ended that long period of the religious wars in Europe, you know, when everybody finally woke up and said, we're really fighting, you know, against a common cultural heritage that we both share. So this is interesting that Kissinger is reviving this idea and is talking about it, because what that really is, I think, is a recognition by someone that could certainly be called a globalist that the paradigm that we've been following hasn't been working.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second, because part of the tension between us and Russia is that Russia is our greatest competitor, arguably our number one, you know, sort of export business globally, is weapons.
Right.
And Russia's our number one competitor on the weapon front, and it's a fierce competition, and it's now entering into space. So there is a serious win-lose kind of competition going on, and I don't know if this administration is going to change that.
Well, I don't think in terms of competition over weapons exports, for a very simple reason. Russia's, if you look at the pattern of Russian weapons exports, technology exports, over, you know, going all the way back to the Soviet era, the Russians never export their top line equipment, ever.
Right.
You know,
they've
just come out with their new Armada tank, which, you know, is probably the best tank in the world right now. Well, they're not going to sell this thing, you know, especially so that we can buy one, you know, on a black market somewhere and take it apart and find out what makes the dang thing work. They're certainly not going to sell their latest fighters, you know, the MiG-35 or any of these types of things. They're going to sell their secondhand, you know, we don't need this stuff
right.
anymore. You have it. I don't think there's going to be so much of a competition there. I think the areas that we have to be kind of wary of Russia is what I've been calling the GMO geopolitics, because they're very cleverly coupling a lot of these issues to this whole soft power card that,
right.
that I also see them playing. And I think they're trying to position themselves to speak not only for Russia, but they're trying to position themselves to be kind of the example or world leader to the disenfranchised groups that they see elsewhere in the West. That's why I think these elections are so critical, and why I think you see the turn within these countries, you know, the Brexit vote in Britain, the Trump election here in this country, why you see people turning away from the global-only crowd, because they realize that if they don't turn away from them, they will be disenfranchised completely.
Right.
So the geopolitical game is going to be very, very interesting to watch. It's going to become very bizarre.
So there are two other things I want to mention that intrigue me about all of this. I spent a lot of time as I was preparing the wrap-up looking at the sort of the unipolar group and what their vision was, and then the new administration and what their vision appears as it may emerge. And the interesting thing is they all have one thing in common, and that is Islam is the man out.
Yes. Yes. I've been saying for many, many years, you know, and don't get me wrong here, I'm no friend to Islam, the religion. The people are a different matter.
Right.
You know, I make a very clear separation in my mind between the nature of the thing and the people in it.
Right.
That's an old Christian distinction, person and nature. But I've been saying for many years, I've had the feeling with events, if you look at the broad pattern of them, since 9/11, that Islam was being set up for a fall. Because you can't have a global world with an entire culture within it that is literally locked into an unreconstructed, unreformed, unenlightened medieval barbarism. You just simply can't. The problem that is really of the West's own making is that Islam has been prevented from listening to its own scholars that have been advocating a reform of the religion and of the institutions of the religion for quite some time. This goes all the way back to World War I. You know, that we had Max von Oppenheim, you know, advocating that Islam and its radical elements be weaponized in the cause of the Central Powers in World War I, and that's really when we had the first fatwa for a jihad. Was the Sultan of Turkey at the time issued one, and of course under Islamic law he didn't even have the authority to do so, but he nevertheless did. And the other thing that came out of World War I was that there were voices within Iran that said the same thing. You know, if we're going to be part of the modern world, we just really have to go back and take a really thorough look at some of our foundational principles. And again, it was the interference of Germany that kind of quashed that movement. So it's been the West that's really, and again, you know, World War I, the British support the Saudis, the Wahhabis that were struggling against the Ottoman Empire, and ultimately set up Saudi Arabia. So in other words, it's been the West that to a large extent has been behind a lot of these radical movements. And increasingly, it looks to me, therefore, that Islam has been set up for a fall. because you don't see the West backing any of these voices for reform. As a matter of fact, you see the opposite. We've seen it as recently as the Obama administration helping to fund and arm ISIS in order to overthrow Bashar al-Assad in Syria. So we ourselves are to blame for this, and now it's looking increasingly to me like they're going to pull the plug on that whole operation and just kind of leave the Islamic world dangling. And that's a very dangerous thing too, in many respects, geopolitically. Iran could step in to fill the void. The Saudis are under tremendous internal cultural and financial pressure. Their attempts to stabilize their regime by some military adventurism haven't panned out. So it's a dangerous time as far as that goes. I think we're going to have to,
right.
We in the West are going to have to own up to our own role in this. We've got to start supporting and being aware of the voices for reform in the Islamic world. Otherwise, you know, that's a powder keg and it could all blow up, and we certainly don't want that to happen. This brings us back to our Treaty of Westphalia and Mr. Kissinger, because there are, you know, even in Saudi Arabia, believe it or not, there are voices for reform. And I read an article last year that really interested me, Catherine. There was a Saudi prince, I forget what his name was, that actually wrote a letter, and I forget where it was. It was an open letter that was a plea to the West that we need some sort of peace of Westphalia understanding here. And I think that's an indicator of just how severe the hardline Islamic world is feeling some pressure. And I only think that that's going to increase.
Okay, so the next thing that's happening is you now have China reaching a size and a stature in terms of financial flows that they have the risk at any given moment of overwhelming particular situations and markets.
Yes.
So I had, as the documentary a year or two ago, Red Obsession, about the Chinese buying up the Bordeaux wine market, and it's a perfect example. But we saw that this year with the one Chinese billionaire coming into Hollywood, ready to make big investments in the movie industry, because if you look at the number of basically movie watchers China has. They're literally, of course, several years ago, they passed in terms of software purchases at the Apple store. So we're literally going into a situation where the danger of getting outpowered by Asia as they converge with us on a per capita basis, we're really going to be feeling the effect of that in 2017.
I think that this is a situation, and I'm so glad you raised China, the USA, and rebalancing in the South China Sea, and all of these questions, because I think with respect to China and with respect to Asia and the Pacific Rim, we can play this smart or we can play it badly. So far, we've been playing it very badly. I think the United States, if it plays its cards smartly with the incoming Trump administration, has a golden opportunity here for some really good trade deals with countries like Indonesia or Malaysia, and particularly with Vietnam. And the reason why I think this is that those countries look at China and you know, they're just looking at this enormous colossus, both financially and militarily, staring down the barrel at them. And with those countries, particularly Vietnam, you have a long history of no love lost for China. Okay. So I think you're looking at a huge opportunity here. And the other thing that I think is a very, very interesting development that we've already talked about briefly is the recent summit meeting between Mr. Putin and Mr. Abe. Because what really intrigued me, Catherine, about that summit was that Japan apparently did not even bring up the issue of the Kuril Islands, which is those disputed islands that Russia seized
right.
at the end of World War II. Instead, what Abe apparently proposed was allowing the Japanese to have free access to those islands. And Mr. Putin's response was apparently, well, yeah, that's fine, you know, just so long as they understand that they're subject to Russian and not Japanese law. And a day later, after the summit was over, and I was predicting this to happen in a matter of weeks, but not the next day, the Japanese and Russians came out and announced that they had signed no less than 23 trade deals representing billions
wow.
of dollars of Japanese investment in Siberia. And what I think
wow.
is happening here, Catherine, is that you're looking at Japan and Russia saying, okay, the Kuril Islands have been a sticking point between these two countries to negotiate a formal end to World War II. Believe it or not, they're still at war. So the interesting thing here is I think they both agreed to use the Kuril Islands as a kind of free trade zone, as so to speak, the interface between Japan and Russia to allow these trade deals to go forward. So in other words, the Japanese are betting on economic development of the Kurils in cooperation with the Russians, and that's going to be their template and model for how they're going to approach their deals of Japanese investment in Siberia. Now, this
right.
is interesting geopolitically because the United States, of course, was signaling to Abe that, you know, they were very displeased with his planned summit with Mr. Putin. And the Japanese went ahead and did it anyway. So in other words, this was a little bit of a thumb in your face, okay?
Yep.
Then
yep.
Abe turns around and visits Hawaii, first Japanese leader to do this since the end of World War II. And he didn't say anything, but he was there. So in other words, he's playing his own diplomatic game. He's becoming very, very independent. On Russia's part, this is even more interesting because I think Russia, and I've been maintaining this for several years, I think Russia is looking at Japan not only as a source of capital for their plans to expand the infrastructure in Siberia, but by the same token as a counterweight to China's investment in
yep.
the region.
Yep.
And this is very, very clever. Now, why am I belaboring all this? Because with Kissinger entering the picture now and saying the United States has to become closer to Russia than China, he's really come out and said that. In other words, the United States has to be the counterpoise to growing Chinese influence. And the way to do this is to cozy up to Russia. Well, look at what Mr. Abe has just done. Mr. Abe has just positioned Japan to be the mediator, so to speak, in any such sort of rapprochement. So, you know, we're looking at a huge geopolitical realignment just beginning in the Pacific. And if Trump is smart, I think you'll see this as an opportunity to expand trade not only with the up-and-coming nations in the Pacific Rim, and I would include, you know, Australia certainly in that. I think you're going to see some very interesting moves from Mr. Trump in the Pacific, and the reason I say that is that we've already had a hint of this when he took the phone call from the president of Taiwan.
Absolutely.
And yep. and looky, what I think could happen. They might apply this Russian-Japanese template to Taiwan in order to assuage Mr. Xi's fears in Beijing and create a kind of a dual trade zone here and allow the Taiwanese to keep their own sovereignty and laws but have the mainland Chinese with free access and vice versa. So this is going to be an interesting thing to watch, if I'm correct, because
here's what Trump's going to have to do. He's going to have to keep control of the sea lanes in the South China Sea, because that is
yes.
going to be the that's the center of the war right now.
Yes.
And if he doesn't do it, then the U.S. currency is on its way down. So I think that, to me, the phone call with Taiwan was not an accident.
No, it wasn't an accident. It was very deliberate. And, you know, I listened to some talk show hosts in this country that were just absolutely berating him for that. And I, on the other hand, think it was a very, very clever thing to do. Because he's trying to position himself as a mediator go-between, and he's going to try and follow Abe's lead here. The other thing I think that we're absolutely going to see, Japan made a very, very smart move by trying to open up discussions with Russia to the extent that it did, because, of course, Mr. Abe has begun the rearmament of Japan. So you're also going to see him use the growing Japanese military power as a means of helping control that South China Sea. And Japan's playing it very smartly there, because by opening up to Russia, they have a much more secure, much closer to hand energy supply. So they're not dependent on the United States to the extent that they were. And this gives them a great deal of leverage. So the Pacific is going to be a very, very, I think, a very hot geopolitical area. I think it's going to be very interesting to watch. I fully expect that because of China's growing menace in the region, that you're going to see India get in on this bandwagon as well, because India and China, of course, have a long history of conflict. So we may be looking, to put it in a nutshell, we may be looking at the breakup of the BRICS bloc and the realignment of that whole region around a kind of a triumvirate of Russia, Japan, and the United States, possibly India, confronting China. So it's going to be very interesting. The Chinese, I don't think, are going to be stupid enough to respond in a militaristic way. And there's been another development that we need to mention here, too, that just appeared, I think, yesterday or today. There has been an article out that China is planning a decapitation move against North Korea. And that may sound rather strange, since they've been kind of quiet backers, but I think there's some possibility that this may be the case. And there's even been quiet talk of joint Chinese-American-Russian decapitation of North Korea. The reason why is that regime, you know, is just about as wacky and nutty as Saudi Arabia. And for the Chinese to go through with their plans, they need a stable region, and North Korea certainly isn't going to help. So I think you're also going to have to look in the coming years very, very carefully at how the Korean situation is going to be handled.
Right. Part of the traditional problem is the Chinese don't want the population moving in.
Right.
So I want to turn now to a subject near and dear to your and my heart. And it's one, you know, one of the reasons we all love Giza Death Star is we can bet that you're going to hear it there first. And sure enough, earlier this year, you started to say, what's going on in Antarctica? What's going on in Antarctica? And sure enough, we're seeing a beaten path of world leaders to Antarctica and very strange questions about what's going on in Antarctica. So tell us, Joseph, what in the world is up with Antarctica?
You know, Catherine, the more I look at this story, the more bizarre it gets. I started out, you know, when Secretary Kerry went down to Antarctica, I thought, what in the name of sense is this for? And the State Department put out this ridiculous story. Well, he was interested in climate change data. Well, you know, he's the Secretary of State. He can make a phone call and have somebody deliver all the data to his office in Washington, D.C. He doesn't need to fly to Antarctica. So I'm, you know, and he does this on a diplomatic tour, essentially. So in other words, in the middle of a diplomatic tour, we have the senior diplomat of the United States going to Antarctica. So that raised the possibility in my mind that is he going there really to study climate change data, Or is he really going there for some diplomatic purpose? And if he's going there for a diplomatic purpose, who the heck is he talking to? <You know? laughs> And then within a matter literally of days, we had John Glenn go down there. Or not John Glenn, what's his name?
Buzz Aldrin.
Thank you.
Buzz Aldrin.
Thank you, not
yeah.
John Glenn. Buzz Aldrin. And Aldrin, before he left, he tweeted, you know, we're ready to go to the launch pad. And I thought, well, you know, you can take that two ways. The most obvious way is he's just being an astronaut and I'm about ready to board the plane. But the other way is, you know, I'm going to Antarctica. So is Antarctica the launch pad that he's talking about? So why do we have an astronaut? This comes within a couple of months of the visit of the Patriarch of Moscow to Antarctica. And again, the Russians put out this story, well, he's going down there to bless a chapel. Well, if you know anything about, you know, Orthodox church practice, you'll know that any Orthodox bishop can go down there to bless a chapel. You don't need to get the Patriarch of Moscow down there to do it. So I began to think, well, why is he going there? You know, Buzz Aldrin, Secretary Kerry, the Patriarch of Moscow. And I started doing more digging. I had a bunch of people send me articles. And apparently, King Juan Carlos of Spain, before he died, had been to Antarctica. Prince Harry of Great Britain had been to Antarctica. You've got all of these world leaders going down to Antarctica. And the bottom line here for me, Catherine, is there has to be some other reason that they're all going down there other than the ostensibly stated ones that we've been sold in public. So the question is, what is it? And as far as I can speculate, I think it's got to be one of two things. I noted in your notes that you pointed out that there's a massive gravitational anomaly lurking between under the ice and surface of the actual continent itself. And that's true. There is a massive gravitational anomaly there. Most scientists think that it's some sort of large meteor impact that embedded itself underneath the surface of the continent, you know, eons ago. And that takes me back to that Martian meteorite that they found in Antarctica that President Clinton made the announcement, you know, back, I think, during his first administration that, you know, we've now found some conclusive evidence that there may have been life on Mars because of all the little fossils that came from this Martian meteorite. So I'm thinking it's got to be that they've made some sort of discovery in Antarctica that is perhaps cosmologically significant or significant from the standpoint of human history. And my guess would be it's either something like that or two other things. They found some sort of off-world technology down there, you know, thinking quite literally of the X-Files scenario. Or, and this would be my real bet, that they have found some sort of evidence of a very ancient human civilization and probably a sophisticated one under the ice in Antarctica. And the reason I say that is, of course, if there's any place on Earth that would be the location of Atlantis, you know, people have been looking for it for millennia. But if there's any one place on Earth that would seem to fit the basic bill of a continent buried or submerged underwater, it would be Antarctica because it literally is
right.
Submerged underwater. I think this is partially the reason for the Nazi expedition prior to World War II. I think this was having something to do with Admiral Byrd's expedition after World War II. And if that's the case, then they may have found evidence that there may have been some sort of off-world contact back then. So I think that there's a huge secret story in Antarctica that we're not being told. Just the list of people that have visited it in the last decade and a half is truly extraordinary. And I'm simply
right.
not buying that, you know, the chief diplomat of the USA is, you know, taking personal time off and at taxpayers' expense to go down there and study climate change data. You know, John Kerry just does not, you know, he's got too much on his plate for one thing, and he's not a stupid man for another. So, you know, I just have a great deal of difficulty believing that this was all about climate change. I'm sorry, I don't think so.
Okay, well, Antarctica is clearly something you want to keep an eye on in 2017. Now let's turn to the deep state. We talked about the deep state, including the fact during the election that the Clinton body count was skyrocketing. But I want to focus on one thing in particular because it relates to 2017. We have seen the application of what I would call entrainment technology, I believe, to
yes.
literally triggering and creating brawls like at the Chuck E. Cheese franchises or
yep.
Now we see fights breaking out in the malls. And
yep.
what I believe very strongly that this kind of technology is being used. Now, another thing that happened during 2016, Joseph, is we did some real digging to try and determine how entrainment technology is being used. Jason Worth wrote a great article about porn addiction, and from what we can see about the explosion of pornography and pornography addiction, we think it's the entrainment technology is being used there. We think it's being used on gambling. All these addictions across many different areas, we think there's very powerful technology being used, and now we see the Chuck E. Cheese. So,
yes.
There clearly are stealth techniques and stealth weaponry. And my biggest concern is, how is this going to be rolled? Is the general population going to be weaponized?
Well, I think to a certain extent, it already has been. And I think the other aspect of this entrainment technology is pure and simple greed and consumerism.
Right.
I do agree with you that these fights are just too bizarre to be completely spontaneous, that we see breaking out at Chuck E. Cheese and the malls and so on. I think there's a certain level of it at work, even amongst the, you know, what are now being called the butthurt snowflakes that just can't believe that Darth Hillary lost the election. I think a certain measure of that is some of these entrainment techniques. I even
right.
go so far as to suspect, Catherine, that this crazed Turk that murdered the Russian ambassador may have been under the influence of some of these technologies, because it's very interesting that the mayor of Ankara, Göksek, came out after that event and said that as far as he was concerned, this guy hollering Allahu Akbar and blaming the Russians after he had shot the ambassador and before he was gunned down, the mayor of Ankara just came right out and bluntly said, well, that's just perception management. And that was a very, I think, astute thing to say, because this kid, to me, strikes me as someone severely under the control of some of these technologies and techniques. And we saw this, you know, you can go all the way back to the Kennedy assassination and to Jack Ruby's murder of Oswald, because his behavior
right.
changed almost immediately when he found out that he was very nervous prior to Oswald, him being told that Oswald had died. And after that point, he became very calm. And that, you know, to me, that's a telltale indication of some triggering and external influence on Ruby. And many people have speculated on that. So I think, yeah, I think you're right. I think we're seeing the explosion of these technologies. And the key, personally, from what I've been able to examine of these technologies, I've been doing a lot of research on them lately. I think the key to avoid exposure to them, and I've been doing this a lot myself lately, is to limit the amount of time that you spend
right.
in front of the computer online. Right. I don't spend near as much time sitting in front of my online computer as I used to. And to dramatically curtail your television viewing, because I have no doubt that some of those technologies are literally being pumped through the wires on cable TV. I don't even have my
right.
cable TV hooked up. I refuse. So I do think, yeah, that there's some of this at work, definitely, in some of these events. And the way to curtail it and the way to curtail it for your own benefit and others is to start talking about it, putting it out there. Many people still don't believe these technologies are possible, but we're seeing more and more evidence in the open literature, the open scientific literature, that they can now, you know, do brain scans remotely. They don't even have to attach the little wires to your head anymore to do an EEG. So,
right.
you know, they've mapped the brain centers, they've mapped the speech centers. There are patents on record for devices that can literally use brain waves to modulate voices in your head. So there's no doubt the technology exists, and this is what we know publicly. So when you factor in the fact that this has been a Black Projects development, you know, ever since the 1950s, there's really no limit on what they might be capable of doing with some of these technologies. So my response to it is simply limit your exposure to it as much as possible.
Yeah, they're going to, you know, I love technology, but they're going to make us, I keep going into avoidance. So before
yeah.
we leave geopolitics, I want to just mention migration and immigration, because these are topics, you know, we've seen two pushes towards migration. One is different leadership in different areas doing it for a variety of political and economic means. You know, the more if you overwhelm people with immigration, then they tend to want government and want central control. So there are political reasons for it, or because your demographics are falling and you want to, you know, there's economic growth to be had by bringing in fresh young people. But the other reason is you have tremendous disparity in wealth globally.
Yes.
We have Asia converging on per capita income, but not the rest of the emerging markets. So convergence is right now really an Asian phenomena. And if you look at the discrepancies, particularly in Africa and the Middle East versus a very wealthy Europe, or in Latin America versus a very wealthy North America, and you look at the population trends, I think the real question is, how do you stop a very frightening and unhealthy level of migration?
Well, I don't know that it can be stopped. In fact, I think to a certain extent that may be an issue that the global crowd, the progressive crowd, is raising as kind of a red herring. I don't think it can be stopped, but it can at least be controlled. You know, immigration has done a lot of good things for this country as well as a lot of bad things. I think what really is at issue behind the immigration crisis is as you say, it's economic and it's also cultural. I think the way to stop it is you have to start planning real investments in those places that do suffer from low income. And you have to, again, you have to get the boot off regulation. You know, there's nothing wrong with South America in terms of their capability or technology or anything of this sort. It's really that they're confronted with such massive central governments and regulation and so on. They face the same problems that we do on, I think, an even larger scale. So it's really getting the boot off and allowing those economies to develop. And part of that boot, you know, let's be honest, part of that boot is coming right out of Washington, D.C., because the last thing that the empire wants is real competition from a Brazil or an Argentina. You know, the booming economy in South America right now is Chile, and for precisely
right.
the reason that the government got out of the way, and they're not going to put up with any foreign interference either. You know? So I think you're going to see the same thing eventually happen in Brazil and Argentina. And once that happens, that's going to change. The real spot for me, Catherine, is Africa. We both know the long history of colonialism there and how that really did not do anything to benefit the people in Africa. You have certain countries in Africa that are relatively prosperous and growing, Kenya being one of them. But I think if we really want to stop the immigration crisis and at the same time turn away from the empire, we have to start investing in Africa in a way that benefits those people and benefits the investors. China is doing this. China's going in there and building roads and hospitals and schools and so on. Why? Because China wants a market. And, you know, right. Africa is a huge, huge untapped market. It has right. great intellectual capital. It has massive amounts of resources. And China's stepping in there and filling in the bill while we're putting in military bases and drones. Well, you know, right. where are the Africans going to turn? Well, they're going to turn to China, not the United States. So we have to, you know, this reshoring has to issue in real trade and real productivity and real items and goods that people can buy. They don't need iPhones and all of this stuff. And the Chinese see this and they're stepping in to fill the bill. I think Africa is going to be, over the next 10 to 20 years, the place that could make or break us in terms of our foreign policy and how we approach things. Because if Africa does take off, that immigration flow is going to stop, both to Europe and elsewhere. It's going to stop cold in its tracks. And you've got certain countries in Africa that are standing up to the invasions of radical Islam, Angola, for example. And we're doing nothing in the West to help these people. The Chinese are the ones stepping in. So if we're going to play the game, we have to take the Chinese model and start applying it ourselves. Absolutely.
Well, this brings us to the next section, which is culture. Because you were the person who really helped me understand that culture is at the heart of the question. Can we, any of the economic or political questions that I have, can we go from a negative return on investment to taxpayers to a positive, or can we shift from a unipolar to multipolar world? Mm-hmm. Can we be productive, whether it's labor productivity or human productivity? A lot of the corruption in the economic or political area follows a corruption and debasement in the cultural area. And culture is really the model we use and the values we share. And the reality is, as you were describing the covenant, if the covenant is worthless, then nothing works. Markets don't work. Businesses don't work. Systems don't work. And ultimately, financial markets can't work because, you know, everything is just the mob.
Right.
So
right.
if you look at the variation in the scenarios that we have this year, if we don't find a way to nourish and maintain a human society, then all of these variables are going to head in a very dire place.
Yes.
So culture is at the heart of succeeding in anything we want to do. And I think, you know, where I start is how do we nourish and rebuild the culture? Because there's been tremendous debasement of the culture in this country over the last 50 years. It's, you know, I never think that anything is hopeless. In fact, you know, I'm a great believer that consciousness can shift in a twinkling of an eye. But if you look at the state of our culture, it's pretty bad. And that's the big question for me. How do we rebuild the field? Because, among other things, the controlled demolitions are going to, if anything, pull it apart.
Yeah, this is, to me, I think, the central question. If you look at Mr. Globalone, and if you look at American culture, for one thing, one reason that this country is so unpopular right now is that our culture is so debased. And if you're, you know, if you're an average European, you're aware of your own culture, you're aware of its high culture and accomplishments. And effectively, you know, we have in this country bastardized that. We have an almost inherent knee-jerk response against, in this country, against anything that could be considered high culture. And as a result, the popular culture has suffered tremendously. So I think this, in part, is also a reflection of certain programs the CIA put in place back in the 1950s as part of their mind control, mind manipulation experiments. It's come out, you know, that the CIA was a hidden backer of a very modern so-called art. You know, I think of the splotches and blotches of Jackson Pollock and people of that ilk, in part. I think of certain trends within popular music, not all of them, obviously, but certain ones. I think part of this also is a reflection of Mr. Globaloney's culture, because Mr. Globaloney doesn't really have a real response to high culture. They look and admire the primitive and, you know, things that are ultimately dehumanizing. I remember a friend of mine actually worked for David Rockefeller, you know, when he was preparing his memoirs, telling me that his office was just full of the ugliest sorts of modern art and very primitive stuff, but nothing from, let's say, a Poussin or a Velázquez or a Rembrandt or anything like that. It was just all ugly. So I think, in part, this is a reflection of the fact that, for the most part, Mr. Globaloney doesn't really have any real appreciation of humanizing things like beauty or the sublime or the transcendent, particularly the transcendent. So I think part of rebuilding the field is we have to start emphasizing new kinds of heroes. We have to hold up people that have achieved some sort of cultural achievement or creativity. You pointed out something very, very interesting, I think, in one of our previous interviews, and that was NFL attendance at, you know, the big professional football games is dwindling. It's going down. And I think, again, in part, it's because they've become nothing but these very bizarre spectacles of a kind of jingoistic patriotism and so on and so forth. That's all that they've become, and people are turning away from that, and I think rightly so. We have a culture that makes heroes out of people that can, you know, throw footballs and so on and so forth and get paid millions of dollars a year. And we need to start emphasizing, I think, different kinds of heroes, people that have accomplishment in the sciences or in the arts and have a humanizing effect on us.
Right.
Unless we do this, unless we start emphasizing and appreciating the high culture, then we're not going to have a popular culture that's worth anything. And this is what the world sees. You know, we export McDonald's and rap music and all of this crud, and yet we don't have a high standard for anything. We don't produce any Bachs, we don't produce any Victor Hugos and so on and so forth. I think we have to start doing this, and it's slowly beginning to happen. I have a friend that he and his wife go and play at various restaurants and bars in California. And, you know, they make a little extra money doing this. They enjoy it, and people are singing songs with them and so on and so forth. And that's good, because it's a humanizing activity, for one thing.
Right.
So I think, right, I think we have to get back to this. You know, we've got to turn off the computers and pick up books and start reading books, whatever, you know, whatever gives you pleasure or whatever your interests are and so on and so forth. You mentioned something else I thought that was very interesting too, and that's that museum attendance is up. And, you know, to me that's an encouraging sign as well. It's almost as if there's this intuitive response of people that realize that as technology and the Globaloney vision of the future increasingly becomes more inhumane, that what humanizes us the most and gives us our sense of emotional balance and purpose, a sense of the transcendent, is precisely some of these artifacts of high culture that surround us.
Right. You know, I'll never forget going, if you go to the Rijksmuseum is the number one museum to go to. Or if you go to TripAdvisor, it's the number one thing to do in Amsterdam.
Right.
And, Joseph, you go into the Rijksmuseum, and I'd never seen a Rembrandt in person until I went to the Rijksmuseum. And first of all, it's a mind-boggling experience. I watched several documentaries on Rembrandt before I went, even one whole documentary just on The Night Watch, which is one of his most famous paintings. And still, when you see it in person, it's just...
It changes.
Oh, my God, it's an... Yeah, no, it's a really life-changing experience. But what was amazing is, you know, you really have to connive and get tickets and, you know, figure out when you're going because it is so packed. And when you get there, you have never seen that many people having so much fun, enjoying so much beauty. And it's just unbelievable to see it. Yeah. So, and it's, as you said, it's unbelievably humanizing. It's right next to the Van Gogh Museum. And the whole experience is just unbelievably, but it's proof positive that how popular, when this is accessible, how popular it is.
Well, it's our innate human desire for beauty and harmony and order and for the sublime and for the mystical and for the transcendent. And this is what, in American culture, above anything else, is what's truly missing. We have truly an ugly culture, if we have any culture at all. And, you know, slowly I think things are turning. You know, we're getting back to the understanding that, if I can put it this way, that the West is the best, that all cultures are not created equal. And that this civilization that was so painfully put together for two millennia is worth preserving, you know. And people I think are waking up to this, you know. I increasingly get people commenting on, you know, what pieces of music to listen to, or share more music, or what performance do I get, and so on and so forth. And It's an innate human response that is inevitable, and I think we're going to see more of it, as we said earlier in the first interview, that we're going to see, I think, just by the nature of the game, we're going to see an increase in human productivity and human creativity and in the arts, because this always happens when humanity, and particularly when Western civilization, goes through one of these big paradigm shifts like we're going through. So I'm actually cautiously optimistic here that this is going to happen. We cannot look anymore to our academic institutions as being preservers and purveyors of a tradition, because they've now sold out, and what they're purveyors of is precisely anti-tradition and ugliness and safe spaces and, you know, all of this nonsense. So people are increasingly turning away from this, and I think you're going to see more of it. It's going to grow. It's going to grow slowly, but I think it's going to grow.
Well, I have to, before we close out on culture, I have to, of course, you know, I have to bring up the J.P. Farrell virtual pipe organ crowdfund, because, well, what happened to me, and this is all, you know, I want everybody listening to understand, this is entirely my idea, entirely my fault. I dragged Joseph kicking and screaming into this against his will.
No, I wasn't kicking and screaming, but I was surprised.
Anyway, but I was visiting you, and we started to talk about your playing the organ, and I've never seen such joy. I thought, oh, my God, you know, because I keep engaging with you. How do we rebuild the culture? How do we rebuild the culture? And I just got this image after talking with you. Okay, the way we rebuild the culture is we get Joseph a pipe organ. This is very simple. And he's going to help us reorganize and elevate our field. So I told you I always have this image of you playing the organ, and energetically the pipes are energetically going up through the ceiling. Anyway, I wanted to just, as we close, mention that the crowdfund has been very successful so far. First phase, we're about 60% of the way to the first phase, and we just had one of the original donors offer a match that we're going to mail this week to everybody through the end of January, which I would like to point out is your birthday month. We're going to have someone matching us, and our goal is to, they're putting up a $4,000 match. Our goal is to raise the other $4,000, which will get us to phase one. And sure enough, your big box pipe organ, I predict, is going to be showing up at Shea Joseph in February. But you just, before we close, you have to explain the 24 tracks.
Well, that was a remark I made at our workshop out in California, and I made the remark that, you know, if we listen to modern music, you know, which we're subjected to at every turn, and I'm so grateful for you to you for using some classical music for your bumper music, but, you know, we listen to a musical culture now where essentially all you have is a melody, sometimes some catchy lyrics, most of the time not, usually some abominable lyrics with abominable English. You listen to a melody, and it's propped up by some chords with a drum beat going on, you know, got to have the beat going on in the background. So we're living in a very one-dimensional musical culture. And I pointed out that if you listen to the opening chorus of Johann Sebastian Bach's Magnificat, you're listening, if you look at the score, there's no less than 28 independently moving lines of music in the thing. So in other words, that musical culture was listening to music and appreciating each individual line simultaneously. It was a multi-track world. And we've lost the ability to listen to music like that. And the interesting thing, I was talking with a friend of mine earlier today about that particular piece of music. If you listen to the whole Magnificat, you know, it's got choruses and arias and so on and so forth. But at the very end of the Magnificat, you know, J.S. Bach being a Lutheran, at the end of the Magnificat, you have the Gloria, glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit. And then in Latin, sicut erat in principio, et nunc et semper et in saecula saeculorum, as it was in the beginning, as now, and ever shall be. Well, if you listen to the way he sets that particular chorus, he returns to the opening chorus. The music is exactly the same, so it's a little pun on as it was in the beginning. And then for the word saecula saeculorum, you know, unto the ages of ages in Latin, he has every line of the chorus holding and sustaining a long, long note. So that's a kind of a textual way of painting the idea of everlastingness, of eternity, and so on. So in other words, these were composers back then that left no detail to chance, none whatsoever.
Right.
And, you know, you listen to modern music, and there's really no attempt to paint the text. They don't even know how. You know, well, this sounds good. You know, I'll play this here. So we've lost even the idea of music as not only something that you get and compose by inspiration, but we've lost the idea of music being something that is composed through perspiration and craft. So, you know, the musical aesthetic has even been bastardized and dumbed down to such a significant degree that getting people to pause and listen with intelligent attention to a piece of music, I don't care what music it is, you know, the Beatles or Haydn or whoever, with any sort of intelligent attention, that's also very difficult. Because for us, music is simply entertainment. But, you know, back then, the aesthetic was rather different. It was for the refreshment of the soul, and that could be entertainment. It could be something different. But it was a very different aesthetical purpose. So this is part of, you know, you mentioned it yourself by mentioning the Rembrandt experience. You go and look at these paintings and see them in person. You know, I've seen a couple. I saw a Picasso here at the art museum where I live. And I'm not a big Picasso fan, I'll grant you. But standing and seeing the actual painting, seeing the brushstrokes, seeing the craft, seeing, you know, seeing the the care and the genius that was put into the painting. You just had to stop and kind of be in awe at it. And this is very humanizing, you know. It's extraordinarily humanizing. And you stop and you think that this is all under assault from a group of people that really have no morality. They have no transcendental understanding of anything. They have no concept or experience with the sublime or with the beautiful. And it's no wonder our culture is a mess.
Well, they one of the things I noticed, because when I remember working with neocon kind of folks when I was in Washington, they literally cannot deal with the complexity of the multipolar world.
Yes.
They are unable to deal with complexity. They are stuck in the one-track mind, and they try and make everything one-track, and when it doesn't work, they use force. And that's why they're so destructive. And so we've got to build people who can deal with the 24-track world if we're going to be successful in exactly where we're going. So it's real funny that I used to have people come over to Hamilton and say, well, how come you're so successful at reengineering when nobody else can do it? And that's because one of the reasons was whenever we do something, we'd write a 2,000-page design book on how we were going to do it and circulate it among the 186 million partners, you know, and people involved. Everybody who was going to be impacted by it had a say in designing it. And we, you know, and the complexity, Joseph, was absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, it made Bach look like a Christmas jingle, but...
I think there's something fundamental that is going on with that, because you're a music lover. You know, you like opera and you go to symphony and things like this. So you've been exposed to multi-track thinking. And I think music is really essential for this. I really do. It had an enormous impact on me. I tell my website members, if you haven't watched them, go watch Leonard Bernstein's Harvard Norton lectures in 1973. Because, you know, talk about a man that's thinking multi-track, not just in terms of music, but in terms of literature and linguistics, and even, as he puts it, God help us, a little bit of physics. It's a breathtaking lecture series to watch, simply because you're seeing how a musician thinks and can deal in so many different levels and permutations and so on. I think music is essential to this kind of multi-track thinking. And again, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you have neocons that can only think in a unipolar world, because listen to the music that they listen to, or look at the art that they pretend to appreciate, or look at the books that they read. You know, it's key and crucial. Culture is a soft part of the equation that nobody can really put their hands on, but it's hugely important. It's what humanizes us. It's our model.
Right.
And when we neglect that, we're lost, quite literally.
Well, that's why I was, as we sit here and talk about culture, I would encourage every one of our subscribers and your members to think about what is the culture that can help them build back to the 24 tracks and really celebrate the 24 tracks that they love? And you have to find your way of doing it that gives you pleasure. You know, I remember I drug one of our mutual friends to the opera for the first time last year.
Well, I know who you're talking about, too.
Yeah, he was pretty good. He said, you know, wasn't anywhere near as bad as I expected.
Well, you know, I always look at opera kind of like I look at baseball. They're much more fun to go to than to watch on TV or anything like that. Because, you know, you're part of an experience there. You're part of a crowd. You're getting the human emotional response to what you're seeing and what you're hearing. You know, culture is participatory. And this is the other thing about our current culture. It really is kind of an anti-culture, because it makes you passive rather than participant in what is taking place. And if you look at the great painters or sculptors or architects or, you know, people that have enriched our culture, you go into buildings, you know, there's a particular building where I live that I just love to go into, because you're really standing in a product of creativity and you're interacting with it. It's producing a response. You're not just passive in front of a big slab of concrete with glass windows on the side. You know, we've got to restore this idea of beauty and make it a part of it, of our culture, because beauty always activates people. The sublime always activates people.
I used to always have wars with the people who worked for me when I worked at HUD, because there was a belief that if you spent taxpayers' money on subsidized housing, it had to be ugly. And I used to say, look, we would lose less money on it if it was beautiful, but that was not politically acceptable. We needed to ensure that it was ugly. And I used to constantly quote to them one of my favorite sayings, which is, beauty is necessary for survival. You know, how can you expect people to get out of this housing and move up if everything is ugly? You know, it ain't going to work. But obviously, I never made that sale.
it's even true in our approach to marketing, Catherine, if you stop and think about it, because you can go into certain shops, usually they're the little locally owned ones, where they take particular attention to the detail of presentation of things that they want to market and sell. And they're trying to do so in a way that's aesthetically pleasing. And then you go into the big warehouse, you know, Targets or Walmarts and so on. And what are you confronted with? Well, you're confronted with a warehouse. You know, there's a certain ugliness to it that is purely utilitarian and nothing more. And, you know, I'd much rather spend time in a nicely arranged shop that there's been a little attention to the presentation and to make things look nice and so on. You know, this is an innate human response, and we have to get back to it. I really think that it's crucial that we do so.
Okay, well, this has been a fantastic part one. We're all looking forward to next week when we'll talk about science, technology, the unanswered questions of 2017, and then inspiration, where we get our inspiration. So until next week, Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on the Solari Report.
Thanks for having me back on, Catherine.